Okay, it is February 22nd. This is Debbie Goldman, who is the interviewer. Hannah Goldman is also recording with us. And this is an interview of Sandy Rusher over Zoom. Sandy Rusher is in, what's the name of your town?
Charleston, South Carolina.
Charleston, South Carolina. And Hannah and Debbie are in New York City. Sandy. Thank you for sending me your timeline and the major campaigns. I think we have a lot to talk about. Let's start first with a little personal information. Tell me when
Wait,
you were.
where did I lose you?
You don't hear me?
I don't have you on my screen. Let me see. I have
Oh.
me.
Go to
Oh,
gallery
there.
view.
I got you. I got you back. Okay.
Great. So let's start with your personal information. When were
Okay.
you born? Where? Tell us a little bit about your family and the community where you grew up.
I was born in 1955 in a little town called Miama, Oklahoma, where the Miami Indians are from.
Can you spell Miami?
It's spelled like people call Miami, Florida, but it's Miami, Miami, in the kind of north western part of, northeastern part of Oklahoma by the Kansas-Missouri border. I lived there until I was in second grade, and I moved to the big city of Tulsa, Oklahoma, where I grew up until I moved away to go to school, college.
And what do you recall about your childhood that may have shaped your values?
It was Miami was a really small town. My grandparents lived across the park. My grandfather owned the Rexall drugstore in town, so we thought we were kind of big deals there, because we could just walk into the drugstore and get candy and give it to our friends, and we didn't even know there was money because they just would, we had the charge account. It was I spent a lot of time with my grandparents during that time. My dad was a football coach, and my mom stayed at home, and it was pretty idyllic. And then we moved to Tulsa, and it was the big city. And when I walked into that, I remember walking into the elementary school that was like bigger than any building, or, most buildings in Miami, and couldn't believe that it was such a large place. So that was an adjustment. But Tulsa was it was a lovely place to grow up, and I stayed there. I went to college at Tulsa University, and so really didn't leave until I left to go to graduate school.
Is there any story from your youth, we'll say, that you would like to share that captures your memories of your youth?
Oh God, Debbie, you should have. I thought I was going to talk about my CWA career.
Well,
I'd have to go.
you
I'd
will.
have to think about that. I'd have to think about that. I'm sure there are a ton, but it's not right on the tip of my brain.
Okay, and what were you, was your family religious?
We went to a Methodist church, and we went every Sunday, and we finally quit going. It was a big, beautiful Art Deco church in downtown Tulsa. My dad always thought it was a little pretentious, and we always fought going. But I was in the choir there, and I, went through the stuff to accept the church when I was probably like in sixth or seventh grade. But I would not call us a particularly religious family.
And
Hold on, pause for 1 second.
should we stop?
No, that's fine.
Keep going.
Closing.
Okay. And what did you know about unions when you were growing up in Tulsa?
Well, in Miami, the Rubber Workers Union, there was a Goodyear tire manufacturing thing, and they were very strong in the community. I do remember my parents said, you wouldn't register as anything besides a Democrat in that part of Oklahoma, because the only primaries that meant anything were the Democratic primaries, and you had to register by party and couldn't vote in the other party's primary. So it was kind of a, Miami was kind of a yellow dog Democrat area at the time. And even Tulsa was much more progressive than like the Oklahoma City and West Oklahoma. So what you think of as now as an incredibly red state in Oklahoma, it was not like that at the time. We had everybody elected were or most of the people elected were Democrats
And you were
growing up.
aware of that?
I was aware of that, and then I was aware when my mom moved to Tulsa. When we moved to Tulsa, she became active in the Republican Party. She was a precinct chair, and I'd go out and help her, walk the precincts and do some political work. But she was quite embarrassed when my sister and I registered as Democrats. It was like really upsetting to her.
Why?
Because she was known in the Republican area, and like she couldn't even convince her own daughters to register Republicans. But the Republican Party was also a different party than it is in Oklahoma now. So, not to be too judgment, my parents were, kind of the fiscally responsible Republicans who were, particularly my mother, also socially. More socially conscious. But when we were growing up there, we didn't know, like, we never heard about, there's a lot about the Tulsa riots now in 1921, and a lot of those kind of political things that were going on. It was a very unlike Miami, where there are a lot of Native Americans and you all live together, next door to each other. Tulsa, with its African American population, was very segregated. There was North Tulsa and South Tulsa, and right where the riots occurred was the kind of border, the Greenwood area on downtown, and everything else was south of Tulsa. And it was quite a segregated place. And then my dad came from the west side of Tulsa, which was kind of the lower income white area. My grandfather was a letter carrier, and because he had kind of the most stable job in the family that was regular, they had a series of family moving in and out of their little house in West Tulsa often. I remember my dad talked about, he and his brother slept in the, well, it was called the wash shed, out back. So he came from that, and probably West Tulsa is still very much, I mean, I still go back to Tulsa, but it's probably still very much working class, predominantly white.
And which was the white part of Tulsa, and which one did you live in,
I
south
lived
or
in
north?
South.
So your high school was pretty much all white?
It was pretty much all white. When my sister and my husband, they were 2 grades ahead of me in high school. We had voluntary busing. So you could volunteer. They took some of the best teachers in town to try to keep from having mandated busing. They tried to create what was called the Black High School at the time, junior high school, and there was mandatory or voluntary busing. So you could choose to go there. You could go there for some classes. Which is what my husband did. He actually graduated from the high school that we both went to, but he volunteered to be part of this new thing.
What year was that, and did you volunteer?
I didn't volunteer. I had gone, we had lived in an area before I started high school. So when I was in junior high, I went to a downtown high school that was or junior high that was quite integrated. And there were some issues and problems there, and so I didn't volunteer to go later. I really wasn't politically aware, and I barely went to school during the time. So
Well, that's a whole story. What were you
yeah,
doing?
Oh, I don't even want to say.
Okay. Just quickly, when did you register as a Democrat?
The day I turned 18.
And why did you want to be a Democrat?
I'm trying to remember who was running that year. So I'm in 55. I was compelled by the candidate, and it may have been a third party candidate. I don't recall right now. I'd have to look back and see who was, but I was compelled by the people who were running for president, I think.
Okay, let's jump very quickly. You went to college at Tulsa University. How did you get to Texas?
I had faculty members who were wonderful in Tulsa and really got me on a road to I was originally a biology major and I changed to sociology. They basically had a social science degree that was anthropology, sociology, and general social sciences, political science, I guess. And I really became aware of things that I'd never been aware of through my through college. Yeah, I always envy other organizers who talk about their experience with their family and unions and how that changed them and that sort of thing. And I think I came to it more academically than I than any personal connection to unions. My grandfather really rarely talked about being in the letter carriers union. I mean, he was, and he saved his all of his pins, and I have those. I kept those, but it wasn't a thing that it wasn't a thing that we talked about, except in a disparaging way sometimes when contract negotiations were in Miami with the rubber workers, and my grandfather, who was the head of the Chamber of Commerce, would rail about that. But I didn't have that kind of experience, and I'm always jealous hearing people have those sorts of experience or growing up in homes that were had left wing political ideology. So I didn't get to it through that route. But we did. I was part of several different research projects at Tulsa University that looked at different things like segregated housing and those sorts of things. And so I really came to it that way. When I graduated, I started doing, I went to work for the state of Oklahoma up until the 19, late 1970s. All juveniles were housed in big institutions. Debbie worked with me on some things in Oklahoma, so she knows some of the story, but they decided to try to deinstitutionalize. They were, as children that were both in need of supervision and adjudicated delinquent that were housed together. And they were pretty miserable buildings, some of them old, tuberculosis wards in Oklahoma and that sort of thing. And I did that for about, so we opened a group home, the first state-run group home in Oklahoma. And that would be like 78 or 79. And I worked there for a while, and I really decided social work was, band-aids over a much bigger problem. Almost all the kids that we had were people who just, didn't have parents that could be around because they were working three jobs, or and they did need supervision, or had financial straits, or had some kind of abuse problem because of the situation they were in. And I decided I wanted to do sort of structural change rather than band-aid kind of change. I mean, it was a moving and worthwhile program, but I do remember we'd sit in staff meetings and decide which of the hundreds of kids that were coming out of institutions, when they turn 18, they just like take them in a bus and throw them out on the street like they do prisoners, right? And these were kids that had sometimes been institutionalized for, since they were 12, didn't have basic skills. And so we did that. We taught them basic skills of riding a bus and looking in the want ads and cooking a meal and that sort of thing. So it was a good program, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. So I decided to go to graduate school and apply to places. And my the person who's now my husband, but that was, you know, not at the time we were together, said I'd go to Austin out of all the places that I was picking to go. And so that's how I decided on UT Austin.
Were you married at that point?
We were living together, but not married.
Okay. You mentioned that when you were at Tulsa University and studied sociology, anthropology, it was through your academic reading and coursework that you started to develop a bigger picture of what I'm hearing is class, race. I don't know if gender was part of that as well. Do you remember any one or two books that were particularly influential in broadening your horizon?
Yeah, a couple. A labor the why am I forgetting his name? You know what, Judy, I mean Debbie. You know, the labor history book that everybody reads. I'm blanking on the name. I'd have to go out and find it.
A labor history back in the 70s. I'm not so sure.
It was even older than that.
Was it Philip Foner's?
Yes.
Okay. Well,
I
you
want to
were.
say Harold somebody, but you, I think it, yes. So that one, you know, obviously the, you know, Durkheim, the division of labor, Weber, the classic sociologists really had a lot to say, and I still look back at that and think, you know, wow, what a gift to be able to sit around and think about those things and read them and think how it applies to, you know, what we're experiencing today. So I think that, you know, like the classics, really.
Okay, and just at this point, you were not involved in an organization.
I did do some community organizing. It wasn't Acorn, it was a pre-Acorn thing, and I did do some an internship with Acorn later and when I got to graduate school. But yeah, I organized our little neighborhood with a group. I loved that. I organized it and then we got it together and my husband came to the thing and they were like, well, they pointed to him and said, you know, he's very gregarious and talks a lot. And so everybody decided he should be the president of our neighborhood association. I was like, yeah, there's something the matter with that. But I did all the no door knocking and he comes to the meeting, but he's got the charisma that
That's
I
not true. But anyway,
don't have,
so let's jump to Texas. You're there in graduate school, and we're going to start with your union experiences. You were part of the university employees. Talk about that, and then the decision to affiliate with the Texas State Employees Union.
Yeah, I mean, I think UEU had been maybe somewhat affiliated with at either AFSCME or the Federation of Teachers. I guess it was the Federation of Teachers, AFT. But they weren't interested in organizing wall to wall across the university, and it wasn't like we had collective bargaining or anything. And so people before me said that doesn't make sense. We should do a, you know, a wall to wall group. And so they had already become independent before I joined. So I started graduate school in 1980, and I guess I didn't even know about it until 82 and joined. And then, like a year later, got on the executive board. And we started talking probably a year after that about affiliation. We had a major lawsuit. That we always, you know, we did a lot of fundraisers and that sort of thing. We had started a form of bank draft, the credit union. We ran elections for the university credit union and got people elected and got the ability to get sort of a bank draft through the credit union. So
Explain what that means.
if people had a credit union account, you could sign up for a thing that automatically deducted your union dues to us, like you could for a car payment or, you know, other things like that. So we had a little bit more stable income, than you would have if you'd had to be hand collecting dues. So
And
we
UEU stands for what?
University Employees Union.
Okay.
So it was, the executive board had people from the library. I was a teaching assistant. We had somebody from the physical plant. We had an administrative secretary. It was a pretty diverse group of people reflecting the people that were in it. We weren't as focused on faculty, but there were faculty supporters that were on the board. And we had a lawsuit that we were funding about a pay raise that the university chose to give to individuals in the positions that they were in at the time, but they didn't give it to the position. So the position didn't raise, like the rest of state employment got a position raise, and the people in the position got it. But if you were hired in after that, you got the increase, and the university chose not to do that. So we had a lawsuit that we were trying to fund, which was important because when we affiliated TSEU, CWA agreed to fund the lawsuit, which was part of our calculation. So we, probably in 1985, we started looking for partners and had been working with TSEU, CWA, the local of state workers. They had some university workers, and they had been doing a campaign at Stephen F. Austin University for many years for with cafeteria workers and lawn workers who had groundskeepers who'd been discriminated against for years and were contracted out, and then they were trying to organize as private sector employees after the contracting. And we had followed that fight and were just so impressed that an organization was willing to take that on in this little East Texas town of
What was the
Nacogdoches,
name of?
Tech Stephen F. Austin University at Nacogdoches, Texas. So there were a lot of things about CWA-TSEU that impressed us. And there were some other unions that wanted us, but I remember one big union, public sector union, said, as soon as you all get collective bargaining and payroll deduction for state workers, why don't you come back and talk to us about affiliating? And we said, well, how do you think we're going to get from here to there if we don't have, a bigger organization backing us? Anyway, we obviously didn't go with them. So we affiliated in 1986, and it was kind of a, critical time to come into CWA, I think. Larry Cohen had just become the organizing director of CWA. An incredible visionary and really believed in the model of TSEU. We had been work the coordinator of TSEU CWA had been Eliseo Medina, who went on to SEIU, also visionary and amazing to work with, but he had left. And literally the day we did the vote count for our affiliation, Danny Fatani shows up at my apartment where we were doing the vote count, and he had become the coordinator of District 6 CWA as an organizing coordinator, and was going to be in charge of our campaign. Would be the major thing that he did. And so it was, I came in sort of, I think, at just the right time to CWA to experience what we viewed as, a need to build a bigger, broader labor movement, one big union, and they did too.
Talk a
And so
little
we
bit
got.
about the TSEU model, why it was so different, and why CWA was interested in supporting TSEU.
The model was that a union is a thing that people join and participate in and are active in and advocates for the rights of workers and, in addition to pay and benefits in whatever way you can, and it's open to everyone. So the good thing about it is we didn't have to think about, because there was no collective bargaining for public workers, and we didn't think that we'd get collective bargaining for a number of years. So it wasn't even like that was the main focus of our work. But that we would have a union, a big union of all state employees, and the umbrella would be big, and anybody could join, and we'd advocate in a way that, you know, union's about workers coming together and participating. And a lot of people thought it was a little bit kooky, and some of the you know, the locals in Texas, the private sector locals were supportive, but a lot of them thought we should break the state up and the locals could be more supportive by having pieces of the state workers in each geographic local around the state, rather than having one big public worker local. And I think Larry and Danny both pushed back on that idea, that although we did get a lot of support from the private sector, particularly political support. I mean, we didn't have any political juice. We didn't have a political action arm of, I mean, everything was political action basically, but there was no separate funding for political action. Everything went into dues. And initially, for other state employees, because they didn't have this option of having the university credit union deduct their dues from their, you know, from their accounts, we did hand dues collection. I mean, so we affiliated in 1987. I was on the organizing committee, and then, I mean, in 86, in 87, I went on to the local staff, and we were still hand, you know, collecting dues by hand and writing receipts out.
That's obviously very hard, but there's also advantages to that. Talk about
Well, I
that.
mean, the advantages, one is the state didn't know who our membership was. They didn't know how many members we had, like you would if you had payroll deduction. But that was true with the credit union too. And so we were trying to figure out, could we do a state employee credit union and do the same thing? We never got to that point. But you have to touch your members every single month, all your members, to collect dues. And so it meant very hands-on. If you didn't have functioning organizing committees, because, you know, maybe if we were lucky, 2 to 5% of your members would come to a meeting that you had monthly. And so they had to be out hand collecting dues. So you had the organizing committee people would have receipts, a receipt book, you know, give people receipts. They'd come in with baggies of cash and coins and that sort of thing. To turn the money in. But yeah, to keep, just to maintain, you had to touch your members every single month.
Why was CWA interested in supporting TSCU? CWA then in Texas, I assume, was a telephone worker union.
It was definitely a telephone worker union. I don't know why I'm not sure. Well, we had an assistant to the vice president at the time. Tommy Parsons was the vice president, but Vic Crawley was his assistant, and he had come from organizing, and he was very, even though the district office was in Missouri, St. Louis, Missouri, Vic was very committed to a big union and trying different stuff out. I mean, even in the 80s, I know we like to think this is the dark ages of the organizing, but even in the 80s, by that time, early 90s, it was getting harder and harder to organize under the NLRA, and to do something that was a little bit different, that was non-traditional. We had a really good political program in Texas. I mean, it sounds crazy, but surprisingly, we did. Like 5 or 6 years ago, people had visions of the Democrats, you know, really taking over Texas and being able to get collective bargaining. And it wasn't that much later that, you know, we elected Dan Richards, and the truth was everybody statewide, all statewide offices were Democrat in Texas. So it wasn't out of, you know, it wasn't out of the question that could happen. It was our biggest group of people in CWA in that district were in Texas. We had some good locals that supported organizing. So I'm not really sure what I don't know why, I don't know why they decided to do it, but they were, they clearly had made the decision. They were very interested in affiliating us and going into higher education. So when UEU got when the University Employees Union affiliated, they agreed to take over our lawsuit that we had had a hard time continuing with just, music fundraisers and that sort of thing. And they wanted to give us, they want us to have an organizer, and we had somebody from our group that I thought would be wonderful. It was not me.
Who was
I
it?
didn't, Travis Donahoe, I wanted to be the organizer, and he did become an organizer as well. And then my thing was that I was the only thing I didn't like about TSEU that I had some criticism of was that they didn't have any women on staff. Well, they had a secretary. I take that back. They did have a female secretary. None of the organizers or the political director were women. And Danny Fatandi at the time, who'd just taken over, was like, "Yeah, it's a real problem, and we need to do something about it." And from the time we affiliated, tried to get me to be an organizer. It took him about a year and a half after we affiliated for me to do that. And I remember, I mean, I had been doing gender. My dissertation was going to be on gender job segregation. And that's what I was working on. And I really came to the labor movement through that as I looked at other countries and looked at how women had, built, had improved the situation of the gender gap and job segregation. And those sorts of issues were, it was unions. They were heavily unionized. And so again, I came to my politics and ultimately the union. Through that, and Danny finally said, "Do you want to be a sociologist who's studying job segregation, or do you want to, do you want to really do something about it?" And I decided I wanted to do something about it. So I
And
never
you
got my PhD, never got my PhD, but I'm still ABD. But I organized some people.
have a PhD in organizing. Do you feel like being in the union movement enabled you to do something about gender discrimination in the workplace?
I do. I do. I mean, both from, the micro thing of by the time I left TSEU, we had a number of women on staff. And I remember the first time one of them had it was actually Judy Graves had a baby. And she was like, "Oh, I can't come to the staff meeting with baby." And they were all day and she'd have to nurse. And I was like, "Well, the guys are just going to have to get used to that." And she came and nursed the baby, and like nobody would look over at her while we were in the staff meeting. But got some great women in and through TSEU that have gone on to national staff and CWA and really made a difference. So I'd say that would be kind of the micro thing, is just the hiring and developing and paying attention to what it takes to be in this kind of work, organizing, field organizing work, and trying to be somebody who maybe had children and had family responsibilities, and how you try to balance those things, and look at the structural problems of just being in this job, this kind of job. I feel like I did make a difference. And then, in the bigger way, the groups that we were organizing, a lot of them were women that we brought into the union, and tried to figure out those, why were those jobs as important as the technicians out in the field, and that kind of thing. Why did customer service, passenger service matter? And what we could do and think about in a different way, from having people have home-based work to just the structure of the workplace and what kind of things we wanted to look at advocating for, and the type of people we organized. So yeah, I think so.
As long as we're on this topic, talk about for you, And you had one daughter, Nellie. What was it like to be an organizer and raising Nellie? How did you balance that?
Well, it was tricky. It was always tricky. The first, until she started school, I took her with me a lot. I was working both in Texas and Oklahoma, a bunch. We had started a TSEU-like campaign in Oklahoma with state workers. And so I had someone who looked after her in Oklahoma and someone who looked after her in Texas. I originally got, this is a little bit negative about CWA, but I'm going to go ahead and say it because I'm sure it's something that a lot of women organizers went through. But I had taken, when I first had or tried to take FMLA in our union, our staff union contract, we were organized. I'd gone onto the national staff in 91 and had Nellie in 94. Said that you could take, you know, that your 12 months of intermittent leave over a 24-month period. So I tried to work what was called, we didn't have a part-time opportunity for national staff. So I had tried to take basically part-time, and for me that was working like 40 hours a week part-time to make it manageable. And I got I guess it was about a year and a half into that. I got approval from everybody to do it, to take my leave. And our somebody in there in our staff union executive board objected and started saying that I was working part-time and there was no provision for part-time, even though the national union had been paying me half salary for a year and a half and everyone had signed off on it. They objected and said if I didn't come back to work full time within a week and a half, I'd be fired. And so I said, since I'm really working full time, I'll let you pay me for full time. And I came back to work full time. But by that time, I'd gotten through the first year and a half somewhat managing. And I have to say, everybody, the men and women that I worked with, were so supportive and helped me through, you know, the whole thing. But she traveled with me. I remember my husband being flipped out that he learned that I was in front of a prison with Nellie in a sack in front of me, handing out flyers. And I said, you know, it's probably the safest place you can be. There are people in, you know, up above with shotguns. Like I don't know that I'd be in any safer place. But she was a good traveler and a good sport. And so it was a rude awakening when she had to go to school. And I had to quit taking her with me. But you know, we got through it.
Sandy, there's so much in your life as an organizer that I want to cover, but I'm going to jump back to two key campaigns at TSCU that I'd like you to talk about. First, I want you to talk about the Stephen F. Austin in Nacogdoches, that campaign for the
For the
cafeteria
cafeteria
workers.
workers.
And definitely about the Jobs with Justice March.
So Danny Fatandi, when he was before he became the district coordinator for the National Union, he was an organizer in East Texas and met this group that had been fighting NAACP. The local NAACP had been fighting at Stephen F. Austin for years about the discrimination when workers would apply for jobs at Stephen F. Austin. And no matter if you had a Library of Science degree or, you know, whatever, you were funneled into either cafeteria worker or groundskeeper.
If you
And,
were
you know,
African American.
if you were African American. So they had Annie Mae Carpenter and several others, but she was the lead on the lawsuit with the NAACP had filed a lawsuit. We're trying to fight it legally, but the NAACP said, we need a union here. That is, we're not big enough, and we don't have the resources to fight the state university. So Danny Pitani was the first organizer to go in there, and they started organizing. And the main source of organizing was in those two units, the groundskeepers and the cafeteria workers. So the university decided they could get rid of the problem by contracting out the cafeteria workers. And so ARA, they contracted out to ARA. And so Danny said, okay, we'll organize them as private sector workers. And it took years of under the NLRB to say, first they said, they're not private workers, they're not private sector workers. So we said, okay, we'll just keep signing them up in TSAU and advocating that way. And then they ruled that they weren't public workers. And so then they ruled that they were workers of a new kind, neither public nor private. So they didn't have the rights. In Texas, weirdly, we used the right to work law to organize, the Texas right to work law, because in the Texas right to work law, and we had lawsuits that we won because they fired people for their union organizing, but it says the Texas right to work law basically says, and this is paraphrasing, that you have the right to join or not join a union. And so we said, we have the right to join a union. It says so in the Texas right to work law. And so we actually got people their jobs back, and we got month back pay and that kind of thing under the Texas right to work law. So they said neither one of them counted. They were workers of a new kind, and it took quite a long time of TSAU, CWA supporting those workers. Finally, they decided they were private sector workers. Danny organized them. We won that election, even after they fired the top third of our leadership in the unit. Then we tried to bargain a contract. They stalled and stalled and did everything they could. And again, I feel like I came into CWA at just the right time. Larry Cohen and George Cole and others had formed this national organization called Jobs with Justice. And it was either the first or second big event that Jobs with Justice had. We had in Nacogdoches right after I'd come. So I came to work for TSAU in the probably in June of 1987. And then Danny said, we're going to have this giant thing in December, the weekend before Christmas in Nacogdoches, where we're going to bus people in from all over the place and have thousands of people marching the streets and in Nacogdoches to bring attention to what's happening in this little town in East Texas. And you know, a lot of us were like, oh, there's no way people are getting on a bus on a cold day the weekend before Christmas and going. But they so besides organizing, we were selling tickets. And instead of like giving free buses and stuff, Danny was always, and it's a throwback to our lobby days. If people had to actually buy a ticket, they were more likely to come rather than saying we have a free bus and a free lunch and whatever to get there. So he's like, we're going to sell tickets and make people commit to being there on a certain day. And you know, we had buses from, it was amazing that day, from Arkansas and Missouri and Louisiana, like buses coming in from all over the place to be there for that event. And it was a huge march down the main street of Nacogdoches onto campus. Like I don't think anything has ever been there before. And Morty Barr, our national president, international president, and Larry and a bunch of people from all over came to it and spoke. But mostly it was the speakers that had endured all those years of all the years of discrimination from the campus. And it wasn't long after that that it broke, and we got the attention was not favorable for Stephen F. Austin. And we finally got a contract there. And we still, to this day, represent this you know, small group of food service workers on the Stephen F. Austin campus. And ultimately settled that lawsuit, Annie Mae Carpenter lawsuit where workers finally got back pay. And I remember going there and handing out the checks to the workers as they came in. And when Annie Mae came in, I, you know, it was quite emotional. I'm going to get emotional thinking about it now. And I said, you know, this check is, you know, is piddly, you know, it's not nearly worth, you know, it's not nearly what you deserve. And she said, honey, I never thought I'd see a penny from this university. She said, this is a sweet day for me. So I always remember that. Like, it doesn't, it's not, it wasn't the amount of money. It was the victory of both having a union there and finally the company had to acknowledge that they'd done something wrong
Do you
for the
remember how
state.
much the check was for?
I don't remember. I wish I did. Larry Daves, our attorney, who had worked there for the years and was is a special person. He'd know all the amounts for everybody. But you know, it was you know, a lot of people coming through, and basically everybody said the same thing, that it was even she probably got the most because she had worked there, you know, a long period of time. But some of the checks were almost nothing, but it didn't matter. People came and picked them up, and probably some people framed them.
And this whole campaign cemented a strong relationship between CWA and the NAACP in Texas.
Yes, yeah. We had that. We've had that all along.
I want you also to talk about the dues checkoff campaign.
And I want to say now the National Organization for Women chapter out there also was very involved in it. So it was a very cool coalition. And I think it was those kinds of fights. We had the most amazing collection of organizers in TSCU that I can imagine. It was the other magical thing about working there at the time. It was people with big ideologies, big egos, a lot of them. But it had opinions about how to do, you know, this new kind of organizing. Or it actually isn't new. It sort of harkens back to the way that workers used to organize. But we had the most fun, exciting, crazy staff meetings of people, you know, expressing their opinion. And luckily, Danny Fatani was one of those people who he liked to fight with you in a good way. He liked a good argument based on something. And so we were allowed to do. We'd have 2 day staff meetings that were crazy, but you would leave with all these ideas and thoughts in your head about all that was said. So it was kind of a heady time to be there, with both, you know, Jobs with Justice, the organizers. But those kinds of fights attracted people. Like, we got Mike Gross, who later came onto national staff, but it was in TSCU for a long time, then the coordinator of TSCU. Those sorts of people, he came out of that fight. He'd been active in both NOW and the NAACP at Stephen F. Austin University. And so we got a lot of people wanting to come and be part, if not full time, an activist, or because we were willing to wage those kinds of David and Goliath fights.
Sounds like you're talking about social movement unionism.
Right. Yes.
Any other names that you want to mention that you haven't already who were key people in this period or that came out of TSCU?
Well, I mean, really, all of the people. Like, I got to start organizing with a guy named Jim Branson, came out of the Mine Workers Union, and it was such a different social. I've talked to you some about my experience with unions younger. For his life, it was before the union and after the union. I mean, it was really AU and BU, and it's what he couldn't understand, that you had to talk people into wanting to have a union if you had a union available. And so he and I took we had the whole northern part of Texas, from East Texas to West Texas, that we traveled. Probably the first month or two we traveled together, and it's a lot of driving time that we got to spend learning about each other and each other's history. but taught me so much about sort of living and growing up and being seeped in Union history and Union songs and Union, culture and values. So I loved working with him. It was such a different experience for me.
Was he from Texas?
He was from West Virginia.
Oh, okay.
And he did go back for a while and start. We did start at the TSEU Bottle in West Virginia. I mean, it kind of branched out to many, many different places and still is branching in our university campus workers organizing all across the. I can't even keep up with all the places that, even since I left, that we've built out a campus worker organizing in this model.
As you continued in your organizing in private sector, American Airlines, the wireless, et cetera, were there lessons you learned at TSCU that you were able to bring to those campaigns?
Yeah, I think that I think when I organized, I never focused people on what are we going to get in our contract. It wasn't about having a contract, although it was. I mean, they had collective bargaining rights and that sort of thing, but it was about building, how do you build power and how do you get power in a workplace and what does it mean to be a member and how do you get people involved and kind of what are the steps and levels of involvement. And I think the we had a whole manual at TSEU. We developed a manual for organizing. We actually did organizing trainings. We tried to do social events at our union or organizations. We really tried to hearken back to what, and that's why I mentioned Jim Branson. You think of what the whole social connection that unions used to be for people. And so I learned that in a number of different ways, organizing with people who had been seeped in that, but also talking to people about how you build this bigger thing without the hope of collective bargaining. So even though the wireless, the private sector organizing was ultimately about getting collective bargaining, it's not the way we tried to organize and say, like, talk specifically about contract language or, if you get a union, you'll get just cause and due process, that it wasn't about specific things you get in the contract. And I think it developed my organizing. I think it helped create an organizing focus that not everybody had if they had, grown up and organized in New York, where it was all about collective bargaining and getting the contract and what do you get at the end of it, rather than through the process of doing it.
Do you want to add anything more about TSCU or should we move on?
I think the other big fight was we did finally get payroll deduction. So politically, we worked very hard in political campaigns. By the time, by the last year, I was the coordinator of TSEU. We decided to double down on getting payroll deduction, and I have to say, I was a little bit reluctant about putting all of our political eggs in that. I said, people are really. You didn't have to go home visit very long in Texas to see the horrible shape that state workers were in and the poverty they were living in. And I said, if we try to get payroll deduction, it's like we have to go all in, and it's the only thing we get. The legislative sessions in Texas are every 2 years, and so, but I was finally convinced that organizationally it was important enough that we have those kind of stability and resources that we make it a top priority. And so we did get Ann Richards elected, and other people that we thought, the Speaker of the House, the Lieutenant Governor, who's basically the head of the Senate in Texas, Bob Bullock, and in 1991, maybe 90 or 91, we got payroll deduction, and our membership in TSEU doubled in the next couple of years
Doubled
after that.
doubled from about what to at its
We
height
had
what?
about 5,000 when I was the coordinator, and it went to I went on then I went on to national staff. It went to about 10,000 pretty quickly without having, we were by that time we were really trying to get people off of not pay cash, go on to bank draft, the bank draft system, and do it through their banking accounts. A lot of people earned so little that they didn't have a bank account, and so that didn't work for everybody. And really, it wasn't until the state required you get your paycheck automatically deposited, and people had to open bank accounts to get their paycheck automatically deposited, that we were able to get, more people onto bank draft. But so 91, I think we got payroll deduction, and it did organizationally, it did make a big difference.
And just to give those who might be reading this or listening to it a sense of what 12,000 members in the state of Texas meant, about how many people were state workers in Texas at that time.
Oh, I think I want to say 100,000 state workers and another 100,000 at universities, higher education.
So
That's
your
probably,
membership
that's
was
a,
about 10% of the potential. And
yeah,
so
or
you
less.
had to. You had to generate power beyond your numbers.
Yes. And
Oh.
our political power, we really rode the coattails for a long time. I mean, I'm glad to say at this point, TSEU is also a major funder of our political action, the CWA Political Action Fund, and that sort of thing. But we rode the coattails of the private sector, especially telco members, for a long time politically.
And CWA supporting TSEU was part of CWA at that point, expanding beyond just telephone. So you were part also of the transformation of the union. And I assume
Yes.
that was could have been a challenge at some point.
Yeah, it was. And it particularly was, and it continues to be, because TSEU is still the largest local in District 6. And at a certain point, we became able to be full members and vote in, for the for all in all the elections and that kind of thing. And so you come with internal CWA political power and those voting rights and things, and so it does become controversial at different points.
Okay, I'm ready if you are to move on to when you went on to CWA staff and some of those campaigns.
Okay, so I went on to CWA staff in 91, and I'd say the main thing, so Danny and I were the two organizing coordinators in District 6. And then the big things we were working on, besides continuing to support these state where we had state workers in Missouri, Oklahoma, and Texas. In Missouri, they did have a form of like meet and confer and bargaining units and that sort of thing, and there were some other unions involved. But cable workers and wireless workers. So Southwestern Bell, which was the regional Bell operating company in our districts, and everybody knows in CWA, our districts only make sense if you know something about the regional Bell operating companies. So we were the old Southwestern Bell. Well, it had been two different companies, but anyway, ultimately we were the old Southwestern Bell, and it was right when I came onto national staff that they were really building out their wireless. They had started it had started relatively small, but all of a sudden it became clear that wireless was the growing part of the company, and they were not those jobs were not included in our collective bargaining agreements. They had developed a different subsidiary, and we had organized some of the other subsidiaries of Southwestern Bell. And I don't even know if I should say this, but I guess if it's history, we should say it. A little known fact is the company had come to us at one point. It was a small number of workers, I don't know, maybe a couple of hundred, and offered us recognition. And a staff rep at that time, who I won't name, had turned Southwestern Bell down because it seemed like a small group of people and wasn't anything, and who knew where the technology was going.
These were
And so,
wireless workers.
wireless workers,
I never
yes.
heard this story.
Yeah. I mean, it's anyway, so we didn't represent them, but it was growing and building and growing and building. And our vice president by that time was Vic Crawley, and he went to we had a decent relationship with the company, I'd say. Like the kind of relationship where Vic would play golf with the labor relations person, and they did our house every year when we had our district convention. They did the hospitality room, and they, came to think. Anyway, we fought when we had to, but it was also a comfortable position. They had labor management, those old, you may remember in the 90s, I guess late 80s, they started labor management committees that you worked out things beyond the contract. How do you get workers to come to work and not take all their leave, and that sort of thing, where you try to work together with the company on mutually beneficial things. So we'd had a decent relationship with the company up until it was clear that they were building out wireless in a bigger way. Vic went to a thing with the company where they talked about the future of the company in the next 10 to 20 years. And they basically said that I think by that time, I'm going to get this a little bit wrong, but either 20 or 30% of the revenue was coming in from wireless and 80 or 70% from wireline, and that would be reversed in the next 15 years. And Vic, it didn't take Vic long to figure out that that meant that's where the workers were going in the next 15 to 20 years, and said we have to do something about it. We met with the company, tried to get some sort of organizing rights agreement. They wouldn't do it at the time. One group was actually co-located with our folks in a St. Louis organization, in a building in St. Louis. And so one of the big St. Louis locals started talking to people on smoke breaks and that kind of thing. And we did an organizing campaign there. And one, the company did run an anti-union campaign. We were surprised. Tried to use our relationship with them to stop the campaign. It didn't stop. And so we ended up winning that election in spite of the anti-union campaign. But as we tried to organize other places were mostly single retail locations, where at that point, the way that it was organized was by, oh, what were they called, Debbie? What were the,
MSAs or met.
yeah, Metropolitan Service Areas. Yeah. So we organized, sometimes it'd be two retail locations in a city. And at each retail location, they were fully functioning. They had technicians who, that was the time of the big phones that you would install in your car. So they had technicians that did the installation. They had drive-through garages in the stores. They'd have customer service, inside and outside sales. Basically, everything was at a store. And so we tried to start organizing the stores, and we got a real pushback. And all of a sudden, this company that we'd had a relationship with, we thought, started calling us very ugly things and talked about us as outsiders. And we knew we were going to have to do something broader to involve our members to push back on the company if we were going to if we were going to get anywhere. So we started a campaign for neutrality. And
Explain
any
neutrality.
so where the company would agree to let the workers decide on their own without company interference if they wanted to be in a union or not. And over the next 5 years, well, anyway, So we started that, and Danny actually was the person who coined the term, we're going to lose to win, that we know there will be an all-out fight. And with these small units of retail workers, sometimes no more than 20 people, it was easy to turn a few people. I mean, the company was doing things like, the big things like all companies do, but they were also really targeting individual workers. So they'd, we, as we drew out the anti-union campaign, it would be like they'd talk to Teresa and say, Teresa, I know you have a special needs child, really needs our health insurance. Go ask the union. When you organize a union, everything is up for bargaining. You could lose something, you could gain something. Hate for you to lose this health care for your special needs child. This is a re these are real stories. This is so it was those sorts of things. And in a small and relatively high turnover, that you could quickly, if they and they would hold up each election. You try to do a retail store, they held it up about whether or not a single retail location was an appropriate unit. We had to do a whole there were metropolitan service areas, but there were also these regional service areas. You had to do a whole regional service area. Outside sales shouldn't be included in inside sales. People who dealt with the agent, anyway. So they'd hold it up forever while there was huge turnover, and they were doing these very personalized anti-union things. And so Danny said, "We'll probably lose a bunch, but that's okay because we're gonna flesh out the anti-union campaign. We're gonna take it to our members. We're going to show our members how this is not the same company that we're used to. They're not our friends. We shouldn't be participating with them in these nice labor management meetings and, having their shrimp and beer at our conferences. And we need to fight in every avenue that and mostly participating with them." This was when regulation of telecommunications was still pretty heavy, and especially in Texas, where we were very politically active, but other states in our district, they needed our help politically, and they always counted on it. They could count on, they could get most of the Republican vote, and we could get a lot of the Democrat vote, and they could get things passed. There were every state had a public utility commission that was regulated, and some of them they were elected, and some of them they were appointed, but still. It gave the regulatory mechanisms were also available. So we started running campaigns that lose to win, that we might lose some elections. We weren't going to be embarrassed about that. We would flesh out the anti-union campaign, take it to our membership, and get people excited about I mean, excited, disgusted, I would say, about how the company was behaving, that we were friends over here and enemies over here. And so that was kind of, we call it the 5 years to card check now in CWA. And we have a little booklet written about it, 5 years to card check from 92 to 97 in District 6, where we had a heavy concentration on wireless organizing. And we would try to start campaigns wherever we could, wherever we had a local that really wanted to organize and be part of it, that we'd do workshops and every opportunity that we could with our locals to show them the campaign.
I'm going to intervene for a second because this is a good time to talk about your, I will say, yours and Danny's and CWA's and Larry's strategy about how do you organize in terms of getting the local involved and building committees. How did you do that in the wireless organizing?
Yeah, and we tried. I mean, we tried to use the what CWA's organizing model was, even
Which
though we
was,
knew that,
explain it.
which was that you find leaders inside, you train them and involve them in the organizing. You build what's called an internal organizing committee. Well, we'd start by training the local, getting the local prepared for what to expect, having the local look through their own membership. There were people who had lost jobs with Southwestern Bell Telephone that went over to Southwestern Bell Wireless. So doing a scan of their own membership, seeing if there was anybody that was over there. So kind of going deep with the local to prepare them, and for to train a local organizing committee to help support the work, because we were talking about, we had campaigns from, Tulsa, Oklahoma, to Abilene, Texas, to Corpus Christi, Texas, to, so even the Texas part of it was pretty big, and we had stuff going on all around the district, with numerous locals. So we trained locals in the organizing process. Then they would work to build, to find people inside, wireless workers, to find leaders, to build organizing committees, and then start talking to workers internally, doing what we call assessments of workers about whether or not they were supporters, neutral, in between, or definitely anti, and then decide if we were trying to move a campaign forward to an election. We also taught them a lot about how important it was to document the anti-union campaign, because we were trying to, the company kept saying, we don't need any kind of agreement because we're neutral. We don't care if you unionize or not. We're used to dealing with a union workforce. And in fact, the president of the head of Southwestern Bell had come out of the actual workforce of Southwestern Bell, had been a line technician, and his brother still was. So they were like, we're not anti-union.
Ed Whitaker, right?
Ed Whitaker. And so we had to, so not only were they trying to organize, they were trying to build and document a case that showed that they were anti-union, that they were running it, that this wasn't a supervisor here and a supervisor here who was off track, off course, but they were running a campaign that was coordinated by the Southwestern Bell, and that they had actually hired a union buster to run it, and it was the same campaign everywhere.
And so educating the unionized telephone workers was as much a part of the program as reaching out to the wireless workers.
Right. And so we actually started a committee of some of the presidents who were some of the local presidents, local CWA presidents in District 6 that could help lead it and talk other locals into using it, and most importantly, come up with other ideas. So, I remember one of the first meetings we had, J.D. Williams, who was the president of the Big Dallas local, said he was also the president of the Texas political action, and he said, "Well, they're asking us to help here, here, and here, right now on political stuff." He said, "We should use that as leverage." And Danny and I are like, "Yeah, we should." And the vice president agreed that we should, that we had to explain to our members why getting this thing done politically might be better for our current members and bring a few jobs in. But in the big scheme of things, if we don't get the wireless jobs, it's going to be very serious for our future, and why we had to work for the future jobs and not just for the immediate jobs and union jobs, and why that was important. So this kind of ad hoc committee that we pulled together for organizing, I think was critical.
How many paid organizers were on this campaign?
Well, Danny and I were the only full-time people that were on the campaign, but CWA's program is helping support locals develop organizing campaigns, and so the hope is that you go when you have, hey, you've got a call center in your area, San Antonio. You have a wireless call center in addition to a few retail things, and they had done organizing on and off, and we'll help you put resources into it. We'll help you develop local organizers who hopefully then can run campaigns, other campaigns in your community. So most of CWA's organizing budget still goes to supporting locals doing their own organizing and developing local organizing staff. So We had Danny and I, and then a lot of local organizers that we worked with
And
that were
did you,
partially paid for through CWA organizing funds.
so they were pulled off the job for part time to work on it. Ultimately, what happened at the end of the campaign and what pushed it over the edge?
We went through four or five iterations of neutrality agreements. The first one was a paragraph with a lot of nice language, but not anything specific, to one that had arbitration, to one that, anyway, as we built on them and the company kept running the anti-union campaign, and we even doing lose to win, we probably won about half of the elections that we ran in. And then the company wanted to do a few things. Sometimes settling a bunch of the NLRB elections, like in Abilene, we got a form of card check neutrality, where workers could, all they had to do was sign a card saying they wanted to be in the union. And if you did it within a certain period of time and a third party validated those cards, they would get recognition without going through a election. And so we got card check for small, and then in Houston, the same thing, the big Houston local, because they wanted to buy another wireless company and set up shop. Anyway, we got a little piece of card check there while we were working under different agreements in the district and other places, and we showed that card check could work, and it could be much less volatile and hostile, and we could remain having a relationship in that process
Can you
without going through
explain? Oh, I interrupted you. Finish.
No, that's okay. Anyway,
Can you
without
ex
going through all
I
the
want you to
controversy.
explain what card check is.
So, card check is when, instead of signing a card to move to an election, you ask people, do you want to have a union? And if you do, the way you vote to have a union is by signing a card. And the card was very clear. If I sign this card, and we actually, the language was developed with the company so that workers knew exactly what they were signing. If I sign this card, I'm saying I want to be represented by CWA. I want to be a member of CWA. I want collective bargaining in my workplace. This is my vote, to be part of the union, so that there's not, like, in regular elections, you sign what's called a representation card, which authorizes an election, and then you have to go through another election. So this is basically the way you get to an election, which is this is the election. You sign the card and say you want to be a member. And you want to be part of it, and you definitely want to be represented, and you've made your mind up.
For
And if
the
over, and it's different percentages. I think in Abilene we had to get to 60%. Maybe we had to in Houston too. It was a higher percentage. Ultimately, after 5 years, we signed an agreement that was over 50% of the bargaining unit at the time you start signing cards. And you had to sign the cards within a 60-day period of time. And the company would not interfere in any way. And they would do a training of their supervisors and managers to make sure that supervisors and managers didn't do it, and supervisors and managers were accountable to them. And we had a contact person in the company and with us that would report anything if there was a supervisor that got, carried away with their own opinions, that managers and supervisors literally couldn't even give their own opinions. They had to tell the workers, you make up the decision for yourself. And if you decide that, then whatever the union tells you, the way is to get representation.
So neutrality is really the key.
Neutrality and the right to join in that way, the right to sign up in that way. The way that the NLRA allows elections to be perverted, the NLRB process, which is an extensive period of time I mean, before we'd ever go into an organizing campaign, we had agreed with the company what the units were, what we had to organize, who would be included. We got lists of names. So there was no question about it. And you didn't have to have the huge period of time between normally in a campaign when you file for an election and ultimately get to an election in small units like retail units. It can be a completely different group of people that are voting than originally said they wanted a union. So when you see, it's really impressive that Starbucks and these small locations that are now organizing in the way under the National Labor Relations Act, those are very hard to do if you have a lengthy time between the time you file.
Just to make it clear, and that is because.
The company will oppose whatever unit. The company has a right to oppose whatever unit you file for. So even though it could be there's precedent, the NLRB has already said a single retail location is an appropriate unit. Under the NLRA, it says you only have to file for an appropriate unit, not the most appropriate unit or the only appropriate unit. So the law actually should give you the ability to file for almost anything, unless it's really crazy, but it also allows the company to delay through the process. And it gives them longer to work on employees individually and as a group, and also to change what the bargaining unit is.
So let's just put an end to the 5 years to card check campaign. What happened
Okay.
at the end and why?
Well, at the end, we got this agreement and we're able to organize all the wireless workers in our district. With the exception of a few, we had agreed that outside sales, which were called account agent executives, who they had really tried to exclude from the unit, but because we'd had to have NLRB elections earlier, we'd agreed that NLRB decisions would be the barometer that we use for what units would be what units. And we finally agreed to card check neutrality with account executives having to decide separately if they wanted to be in. And so everybody, with exception of a few small groups of account executives, quickly chose to be represented when you had the opportunity to do it without a company campaign and without being threatened and harassed and intimidated.
This was 1997. What was going on in terms of corporate change with Southwestern Bell in 1997?
They were having mergers all around the country. And again, this goes back to the regulatory process. You're going to have to help me. But Pac Bell, I think, was that the first big one that they got for RBOC?
In 1997 is when Southwestern Bell and Pacific Bell filed for merger, and they had to be approved by not only the FCC at the federal level, but the California Public Utility Commission, which was a high road to climb.
And again, our union in California, also politically active, had to really jump in and decide that it was better for them to be part of Southwestern Bell and have neutrality on wireless jobs and other jobs. I mean, the truth was the first unit we organized under the card check agreement was a cable group. Southwestern Bell was going into broadband and cable, and I organized it was a relatively small cable unit in Dallas that I'd been working with for a while, and I kept saying, "Hold off, hold off. I think we're going to have something where you're going to be able to organize without going through hell." And a number of them had been in cable campaigns with other cable companies in the Texas area that had I'd been involved with, and I said, "Remember how horrible those elections were? Well, we're going to not have to do that if you give me another 6 months." So that was the first group we organized under the new agreement was this broadband Southwestern Bell broadband unit. But so CWA there jumped in and helped support the merger. And then that was the case as Southwestern Bell became the little RBOC that ate all the other RBOCs, regional Bell operating companies around the country. That same thing happened. And even some, so the Southern New England Telephone Company, so some of them weren't necessarily regional Bell operating companies, but Bell South, Ameritech,
And ultimately AT&T,
and ultimately AT&T.
and renamed itself AT&T. So at its height, how many wireless workers did CWA represent approximately? After all of these mergers, that CWA got the expansion of the card check neutrality.
Well, then see, then I'm trying to think. I know that I believe when I left 4.5 years ago, we were over 40,000. That included DirecTV. They bought DirecTV as well, but between all their mergers, we represented over 40,000 workers in the wireless. DirecTV went into the wireless arm. Yeah.
A very proud achievement for you and Danny and Vic Crawley and all of the activists who were part of this campaign.
It was Larry's. I mean, we left a we used to have annual organizer retreats, and this was Larry's vision, and he said all of us had to go into our districts and start moving this. And so people did try to do it. I think we both had some regulatory hooks that maybe some people didn't have, and we had Vic as a vice president who was super committed to it and was willing to. I mean, I remember times when Danny and I would say, he said, I don't really want to know what you're doing. I have to maintain a relationship with the company. I still have a relationship with labor relations. You all have to do what you have to do. And sometimes we'd call and say, it was a Friday afternoon. Maybe you want to get out of the office so you can't take calls. And we'd go do, some crazy thing in front of some of their retail stores, or that sort of thing that they go wild about. But we did have fairly free rein to kind of raise hell where we thought we needed to. So we were all given the charge by Larry to it was clear where the industry was growing, and Debbie did a ton of research. That really helped guide us to help figure out what the jobs would be and where they were and what we needed to do and what if there were regulatory and political angles in the wireless part of it that was pretty deregulated, except for giving them metropolitan service areas. I think they had to have two carriers in each metropolitan service area at the time or something. But anyway, Debbie actually knows that better than the deep research on the industry better than I do. But yeah, it was a major feat, and we had no way of knowing. We also were lucky. Who knew that Southwestern Bell was going to be the one that ended up being the new AT&T with so that it did apply in other places.
I
You
think
have
that,
10 minutes.
I think that this
Okay.
is, first of all, fabulous. Sandy, you tell these stories so well. We are at, I think we have 10 more minutes. We will need to reschedule to complete this. I'm interested in the next, block being about the American Airlines campaign. I don't know if you want to start on that, or should we just stop now and pick up with that when we get it, talk next time.
Oh, how do you want to? I'm good. Anyway.
Why don't we start? And at
Okay.
10:15, we'll stop.
Okay.
Okay, Hannah? Okay, so
So I'm going to name drop a little bit more then, because we started in the airline industry with US Airways passenger service agents. So I want to say that was 90. 94 or 95. I didn't have that much US Airways in District 6. It wasn't a big airline. I had six airports, I guess, with relatively small groups and no call center. So the passenger service group in airlines, let me start with that, is are people who work at airports at ticket counters, who do in legacy big airlines. It does not include the baggage people. I'll talk about our future, our other regional jet campaigns later. But so in the legacy carriers, passenger service are ticket and gate agents at airports, people who do lost baggage. So when you lose your baggage and you have to call someplace and find out where your bags are, it's that kind of group of people, and customer service reps who do the ticketing at call centers, which is where our initial, so people who worked at call centers initially contacted us in a couple of places at US Airways because they were like, oh, that's the union that organizes customer service workers and call center workers. So we originally got our contacts from there at US Airways, and Rick Braswell, who was the national, he wasn't the national, I mean, really after, well, from 86 until Larry got elected as executive vice president, and even after that, he was the organizing director. And Rick helped run national campaigns, sort of his assistant, but never had that name. He was a district organizer like the rest of us, and he ran the national Sprint campaign, which Debbie has written on extensively, and he ran this campaign really brilliantly, I must say, and used kind of was really brought CWA's both kind of online stuff and like campaign literature, and I like it to a whole new level, I feel like. But so the we started at US Airways.
Can
I
I
think when we
stop you, Sandy? Because people who are listening to this will say, okay, CWA was a telephone worker union. Wireless makes sense. Maybe even public workers in Texas. But why the airlines? And how did CWA decide to pour resources into this and why?
Yeah, it's not only a new field for us to some extent, it was a different law. It was the Railway Labor Act, which is a completely different, has completely different organizing rules and bargaining unit issues. And, you know, there is no unfair labor practices, and there are none in under that. So it was a real difference for us, except that over half the workers are you don't see when you go to airports for customer service. They're the people that are on the telephones doing customer service work, and we are a customer service union, and we had been even during that time really promoting ourselves as the union for the information age. Customer service, you know, so it was a broad thing, and we and that is where the initial context came from was customer service, call center workers. So that was the way we were led into it. And some people had actually lost jobs, like when call centers had closed down in their area, they'd lost jobs, they'd gone to work for these call centers, or parents who had children. Who customer service workers for the phone company who had children who'd gone to work for the airlines, and so we had a lot of connection with that kind of work, and we'd been bargaining on issues from that they were having from you know secret monitoring to the speed ups to the you know we could go into all the issues, but all the issues that customer service workers were having, these workers were having at US Airways.
So you weren't that involved in the US Airways election. So let's just stipulate after a long time and several elections, CWA did win the election to represent US Airways. You got involved then because American was merging with US Airways, correct? Or had already merged?
No, that was a lot later. The merger came a lot later. I got involved because American workers had been trying to organize. They'd been working with the Teamsters for a while. They hadn't gotten anywhere. They hadn't gotten to an election. They were monitoring. We got contacts through the US Airway campaign when we'd be in airports. And that was before, that was when you used to be able to walk through airports freely. You could go, there was no security. You didn't have to have a ticket to get in. You could just, many people will listen to this and not even know that that was the case at one point, that you could, it was like, and there were customers walking up and down. So you could walk up and down airports and talk to passing, customer service agents, and nobody would pay any attention. They thought you were getting up, asking a question about the flight. It was kind of fun organizing. Well, it was actually very fun organizing. But so in the process of organizing US Airways, American agents had contacted us, were interested. We said, let's get through this campaign, and we were taking names of and other United and Delta. We were getting contacts from many passengers. It's a very heavily organized industry, except customer service.
And
And
by then,
so
had the flight attendants joined CWA?
they didn't join until, I want to say, 2004. I did work with them in 2001 on their Delta campaign, just as a support person. They had a base in Dallas at the time and Houston, and I was, working a lot in airports in Texas. So I worked with them in a friendly way to help organize. But I think it was 2004,
Okay, so back
around
to,
there. So back to this.
I think we
I've got.
probably, I think we should
Okay.
probably stop now. So
Okay.
look, I'm going to stop
Let
the re
me finish. Let me finish when they came. Let me finish this
Good,
part.
good, good, good.
Right after we won, we had like 300 American agents sign a petition saying, please help us organize. We want to do, we your campaign at US Airways was fantastic, and we want that too. So we started meeting with them after we got a petition asking us to.
And that was what year?
So that would have been 96, maybe 96, I think.
Okay, we have a lot to talk about. I'm going to stop recording. Don't hang up.
End part one. Begin part two.
Sandy, we're picking up now. Today is February 26th. We're on Zoom. Sandy is in Charleston. Well, Sandy, what town do you live in?
I live in Charleston, South Carolina now.
Oh, it is Charleston, your town?
Oh,
Okay.
it's Mount Pleasant, but no one will know where
Well,
that
she's in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, which is just outside of Charleston. Hannah Goldman is on Zoom, and Debbie Goldman's conducting the interview and is also on Zoom. Sandy, you talked about why CWA responded when US Airways, I think it was first reservation agents, maybe gate agents, reached out to CWA,
Yes.
and why, as customer service, it made some sense. The profession, rather the industry, was one that was common with what CWA represented, one of the only unionized unions that represented call center workers. Now talk
Yes.
to us about, and Rick Braswell of the National Office coordinated the US Airways campaign. How did that lead into then American organizing, gate agents and reservation agents at American? And tell us that story. It's a interesting and long story.
Well, even though we'd at US Airways had originally been contacted by the reservations agents, included in the can I I'm going to talk a little bit about the Railway Labor Act and the National Mediation Board. Because there would be a lot of dates in here, and I'll just say generally we had campaigns from 1995 until 2000 and was it 16 when we finally won at Envoy. So we had in terms of passenger service agents, campaigns with US Airways, which we had to have several elections. There was a lot of legal stuff in there. American Airlines, we had three elections. American Eagle, which turned into an airline now flying as Envoy. We had two elections, and Piedmont passenger service agents and Ramp. It was kind of a different category, but we had two elections. The Railway Labor Act, and then once the flight attendants, Association of Flight Attendants merged with CWA, and I think that was around 2004. We had elections and numerous elections, but the big ones were a Delta election. It was their second, our first one with us, with them. And then we had a second one when Northwest Airlines merged with Delta. We lost that and are still working on Delta. And a big one when Continental and United merged, and United was represented by AFA CWA and Continental by the machinists. We won that one, and that was very large. So we worked on a lot of airline campaigns, and the big difference is that it's included under the Railway Labor Act. The governing body is the National Mediation Board. It's a three-person body with two in terms of party who gets to assign them. It would be two people that are designated by the whatever party's in charge of the White House and one in the other party. So that changed during the many years from 94, 95 when we started US Airways through now. And I'm just going to say one more thing about the law. The biggest change came in under President Obama in 2009, 10. I think we finally got it through in 2010, where under the I'll say there are several big differences, but under the Railway Labor Act, units have to be nationwide. So you can't do one reservations office in Dallas by itself, or one airport like DFW Airport by itself. There are no single location units unless it's a flight attendant unit and they only have one base or something like that, then it's sort of a single unit. But otherwise, they're nationwide units that you have to organize. And until 2010, after President Obama appointed Linda Pachalla to the National Mediation Board, she's a former flight attendant. You had to win by a majority of those who were eligible to vote. So the eligibility list was everything, because if a person didn't vote, they were considered a no vote. And then the other thing is, when you get the eligibility list, unlike under the NLRA, you get a list of people and their home addresses, so you can kind of contact them if you need to, or do mailers or whatever. And again, these are nationwide units, which include the territories, Guam, Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, those kind of places. No addresses. You get the location, their job title, and the location that they either work at or they last work at before they were furloughed. Then, which is a bit another big thing under the Railway Labor Act, is that whatever the company furlough policy is, if they're still furloughed and have recall rights, they're on the eligibility list. So if somebody's been furloughed under American Airlines, it was a 10-year for recall, right? So even people who had been gone that long, unless they had gone to work for another airline, which would have excluded them, but if they were furloughed, you had to figure out, we would have had to figure out if they'd gone to work for another airline or something like that. And again, they were considered no if they just didn't vote or they hadn't kept up with the company with their address, any of those things. So that sets the stage for a learning curve for us. Under the Railway Labor Act, there are also no unfair labor practice charges. You can't like halt a campaign because of an unfair labor practice charge. At the end, if you lose, you can challenge the election. So you just document along the way all the atrocious things that the company does. And then if you choose, you challenge the election. So when at US Airways, we challenged the first election that we lost. We won that challenge. We had a second election. It freezes the bargaining unit at that challenge. We won the second election. The company kept litigating while we were bargaining, and ultimately, in the courts, overturned that right in the middle of the American election.
Overturned what?
The decision we'd gotten, which is that there had been interference in the first election. The company created a company union and said, you don't need a union. And under the Railway Labor Act, that's illegal. So we got a second election, won strongly while we were in bargaining, and we'd bargained about 90% of the contract by then. This would have been in 98, right? This was now 98. They had continued to move it through the courts. The company had, they'd actually challenged the NMB, not us. So the lawsuit was against the National Mediation Board for their decision to overturn or to give us a second election. And when the court came down with the decision, we could have either taken it on to the Supreme Court, which would have taken years, or we felt like our unit was so strong. We just go forward with the third election, which we did, and we won by a very high percent. And the company implemented the 90% of the contract that we'd bargained. So they gave them everything that we had bargained at the table, except we were right at the end of like wages and stuff. So we got back to the bargaining table quickly and got that. So on American, we got a petition from several hundred agents who said, come work with us. They had really found out about it through the airports. We got the contacts initially at American through the airports because they oftentimes work side by side with the US Airways people as organizers would be walking through the airports, talking to people. We'd stop and talk to agents of many different airlines. The American agents had been in the past working with the Teamsters. Internally, the Teamsters decided they didn't want to move forward with a big national expensive campaign like that. And so my initial contact was the guy who presented this petition and had been fired for his union organizing with the Teamsters, and was continuing as an organizer with the Teamsters, but the Teamsters had basically said, go ahead and take it. I mean, the database and everything. And so we started going to, we were out at airports anyway, talking to US Airways agents. The reservations offices are very excluded. So we started at airports and we were like, wow, this is going to be easy. There was so much support at the airports, it was overwhelming. I remember my first time I went around DFW Airport with Mike Lavolo, who was the fired American agent. And it just people were running up, hugging us, saying, will you help us organize? Will you help us organize? Thought that the campaign that Rick had run at US Airways was brilliant. And
And
so
why were they so eager to have a union?
they've been There were a lot of things that were going on. There was a company in-house grievance procedure that they They never won in. People tried to do it, and you couldn't win. There was mandatory overtime and no rules on it. They could just say, because you're at gate, C36, and you have a flight that's way late that's coming in from San Antonio, you have to stay here. You might have been junior, senior, you might have worked a double shift. The Fair Labor Standards Act also doesn't apply in the airline industry, so they can work you really long hours, and there's a different wage and hour kind of thing at airports. But they had at the airports, they'd been turning. American had a regional carrier, a low cost regional carrier that was called American Eagle, and so particularly at medium to small airports, they just all of a sudden say, "This is an Eagle location. And you can go to work for Eagle. We'll give you a job with Eagle, but you lose your wages." The wages were much lower at the low cost carrier, or they just contracted out to contractors. So people at small and medium airports were really nervous. We had bargained a thing in the U.S. Airway contract about what happens if there are so many mainline flights going in to an airport, they have to be paid as mainline agents. And so airport people were really excited about that. So a lot of uncertainty in the airline industry, no protection. And at airports, everyone that surrounded them were in the union. So at American, there was the pilots, the flight attendants, the groundskeepers, I mean the grounds workers were all union, so they saw what the difference was between having a union and not having a union. So we started taking that campaign on, and then we got to the reservations offices, and it was a whole different story. And under this is another thing under the Railway Labor Act is the units had been the decisions about who was included in what unit were made years and years ago. Often when small reservations offices would be like at hangars at airports and people would move back and forth pretty smoothly. By the time we started this campaign, that wasn't true. These were mega centers that were enormous with I think our one in Dallas had 1,500 to 2,000 people. I can't remember how big it was, but they were very large centers where you couldn't easily move back and forth from the airports. They had no connection with airport employees except for like in the case of Dallas, and I say that because that's where I was the district organizing coordinator in that region at the time, and so that was my big location was DFW Airport and the reservation office that was out close to the airport. So we got to the reservation offices and it was a different story. They had been running a serious anti-union campaign during the Teamster drive. People were, pretty turned off by that. Is Hannah still available? Did her saw her picture? Oh, there she is. Okay. And it was very hard to talk to people, unlike at the airports. This is still before the security at airports became where you couldn't get in as easily get in. So we did get to the point though that we worked for several years, started signing cards. The cards are good for, I think, a year under the Railway Labor Act. You can petition with 35%. We wouldn't have petitioned with 35%, but we got to what we thought. And again, the unit is tricky, who all's included and who's not. But got to the point where we had, well over 50%. Went to the first election. The unit was padded. They gave a list that was ridiculous. That included a lot of people who had been furloughed for years of stations that had closed down. Some of the people had gone to work for American Eagle, and we had to prove that. And all of that weight is on you. You get the eligibility list. And then during the election period, you have the right to challenge the eligibility list, and they start taking people off. They do mail ballot elections because in this case, like, we had a very large group in San Juan, small group in I think the Virgin Islands. So it was large and overwhelming. It was a real opportunity in terms of the CWA organizing program to involve a lot of people in organizing. There was no way, our national organizing staff was there was there were one or two district organizing coordinators in each district, and one at the national union. And that was pretty much the staff that we had at the time.
So you're talking about 10 to 15 people?
So we had to involve, and we had I'm forgetting the number of locations that American had, but it was over 100 locations. I mean, the big ones, two-thirds of them, I'd say, were in a certain number of states, at least. We had big states, and of course the big hubs for airports were Chicago, Dallas, Miami were the big ones, and then you had LA and New York and those areas. And then there were at that time, I think, five big reservations offices, and then some smaller ones. The three big ones were in North Carolina, Texas, and Arizona.
So how did the organizing program do this with 100 locations?
We involved locals. Some locals would be in certain geographic areas and just have a small airport. We took people kind of almost permanently off the job in Arizona, North Carolina, and Dallas to help run the campaigns in those areas. And so we definitely had strong internal leadership in the American group, but in some places, we couldn't find anybody initially, or you might have one or two people. It's very hard when the company starts running an anti-union campaign to be the even if it's a location with only 20 agents in a small airport, it's hard to be the one person who stands out as the leader at that location. So we had, with the internal organizing committee of American agents, we had regular, there were no Zoom calls at the time, but we had regular conference calls. We tried to do regional in-person meetings because they could fly for free, and we tried to have regional meetings to connect people physically with each other, like a organizing campaign would. And I mean, we used the basics of CWA's organizing model, the assessing everybody, finding internal leadership, trying to build a 1 to 10 structure. I would say we got to that at some of the airports. We never got close to that in the reservation offices. It was a brutal campaign in the reservation offices. They'd have TV monitors all over the place with full-time anti-union videos going on all the time. They'd let people off the phone, which everybody, I mean, we know this from call center workers. If you said, "Do you want to go, see an execution?" people would volunteer to get off the phone. And in this case, it was, "Do you want to go hear about the union?" And we encouraged our committee people to go so they could refute things, but everybody wanted off the phone. So it was like really nonstop, those kind of things. It was a weird thing, though. They let inside the airports, I mean, inside the reservation offices, they had vendor tables. So if you were an employee, you could sell, if you did macrame or you had supplements that you sold, like health food supplements or knockoff purses, or like it was crazy some of the things that people had there. You did tie dye. You could set up a table and run it in the middle of the one I had in Dallas had a huge atrium in the middle of it that employees could set up tables. So employees on the committee would get tables and do union tables inside the res offices. But people were scared. They were monitored. It was an atrium with a second floor that had a balcony on it, and they would be taking pictures and monitoring who came to the table and that kind of thing. And the agents knew it. So
Were
that,
activists fired or disciplined?
yes. Yeah. And again, you have to take those to court. There's no internal process for that. So that's why, when Mike Lovolo had been fired with the Teamsters chose not to take it, not to go through a court proceeding, because there was no other proceeding that you could go through. And it's interesting, in later years, while I was the organizing director, people had the idea that if we could get to court and not have to go through the National Labor Relations Act and the board, it'd be better because you could go through discovery and do a lot of things that you can't do in under the process that you have to use first before you go to court in the NLRA. And I said, oh no, I'm we've been under we've done that under the Railway Labor Act, and it's years, and it's not a good process.
What
So
year are we talking about, and how big was the unit, and how many lost time organizers do you think you had?
I'm not going to know the last one, Debbie, but I want to say, so the first election was in 1997. It was 17 to 18,000 people. We didn't have enough lost time organizers. It certainly wasn't, it wasn't, it was not nearly big enough. So DFW Airport, I had, well, all of District 6, but just DFW Airport and the res office together were probably almost 3,000 people. And I had a couple of organizers, lost time organizers, working with me on it, and Mike Lovolo was there. That's where he was located, and so we kind of had the headquarters of that campaign in Dallas. It's where we kept the database. Again, we didn't have sort of these national databases that could automatically sync up. So we had to like sync the data every night when people would get their data in, to try to have one database. So it was more complicated than it was in our last election for American. So we lost that election. I want to say, I'm trying to remember. It was pretty big. Maybe we got 40% of what ended up being 42% what ended up being eligible voters. So we lost that.
Can I ask another question? Lost time organizers, did they come out of the traditional telephone units? And within CWA, was it controversial to be spending resources on organizing in the airlines? In Air American, you'd already done US Airways, I guess.
Some of the lost time people did come out of the traditional phone company. I had in Dallas a woman who was at one of our call centers with Southwestern Bell. Her daughter worked at the reservation office at American. We did one of my favorite pieces ever was Anne and Joanna, her daughter, a comparison between Anne McQuarrie and her daughter and what their work life was like, and them talking about it, and her being so excited when she heard that CWA was Anne, the mother, when she heard we were organizing there and volunteered, wanted to help, and it was her first organizing campaign. So there was also somebody who worked at one of the call centers and had actually worked at the res office once. and it was so brutal. She came to work. People liked the flight benefits, but that was about it, and what they liked about the job. At that point in reservations, your pay was based on, it was called PER, performance evaluation review, or anyway, it was based on your how many tickets you sold, if the people actually got on the flight of the ticket that you sold, so how many actually flew. So it was really complicated formula. People couldn't figure it out themselves about whether or not they got paid the right amount or not. That was at the reservation office. So it was a natural fit with the telephone company call center people to work on that with us. The airports were a little bit different. We did finally have the contract at US Airways, and so we could get them off some. It wasn't as lenient of a leave policy as we had at Southwestern Bell and some of the other regional Bell operating companies. But it was in terms of being able to work on the big ones, we could have a lot of people working on the small ones, because if you took a day here or a day there, it was fine in most places under our contracts with the phone companies. But if you took too much time, it was a problem, and we either had to get people off like for permanent leaves, for 6 months at a time or something like that. And I couldn't really tell you. Every one of the reservations offices, we had at least one, sometimes two people working almost full time on them. The airports, a lot of the district organizing staff did the airports, and just ran those, worked almost full time on that.
And what was the gender and racial breakdown of the units?
The reservations offices were heavily female, and depending on where you were, pretty heavily, more heavily people of color. But it changed over the period of time that we had it. It got more and more people of color as they lowered the pay and started having people work from home. There was a certain period of time where they only hired people to work at home, and it was a much substandard pay than the people who'd been in the offices, and it became more people of color that worked there. The airports, it really depended on where you were. If you were in Miami or you were in Chicago, but it had more males at the airport. I'd say it's probably 50-50 at the airport, male and female.
Okay, so I think we lost the first, CWA lost the first
We lost the
election.
first election. The company had set up a company union. We filed similarly to what we filed at US Airways when we won with the National Mediation Board. The National Mediation Board took a while to decide, I mean, a long time. And in hindsight, it looked like they were waiting for the court to rule on the case against the National Mediation Board. And when we lost that lawsuit in court on US Airways, the NMB ruled against us right away. So we didn't get a second election at American,
And
and
this
we
was under
said,
the George Bush
yeah,
NMB.
98.
I think
What are
so.
we?
Obama came in 2009. So I think 98, we were still, the US president was George Bush.
Okay. So we
Wait a minute.
regrouped.
Wait a minute.
No, would that have been
It was
Clinton?
Clinton. It was Clinton.
Yeah.
Okay, it was a
They
Democratic NMB.
so I think, I mean, they don't ever tell you. It's not like they sit down and say, we had to rule against you, because but they didn't want to lose credibility, I'm sure, with Congress. And if you had ruled again on similar, not the same, not the exact same facts, but similar facts in our favor after you'd lost in court, And then we hadn't challenged that decision because we decided not to take it to the Supreme Court. So that decision stood, and then they had to decide on us. So anyway, we tried to regroup. In the interim, we did an American Eagle election. American Eagle was their regional carrier. And again, while we had been out on talking to American agents, we talked to a lot of Eagle agents. At DFW Airport, there's like two wings, two terminals that are just American, and one terminal that's just American Eagle that are attached. And the thing about American Eagle is they didn't have reservation offices, and that's what really crunched us. I mean, that's what really killed us the first election, was our lack of support there. And the difficulty, I think we really came to recognize, if you have an all-out anti-union campaign, and even though the broad unit we had well over 50% signed up in the reservations offices, I think my reservation office got to the highest of any, and it was at 35%. And it's very hard to hold on to minority support in that kind of intense anti-union effort.
Minority, you mean minority by numbers or by
Yes.
not
So we only
racial?
had, yes, no, the 35% that we had really brave, strong people that were out, that would stand outside in handbill, that would staff the tables inside, that used the opportunities to, I mean, it's hard to talk to people in call centers. People have their headsets on, they're monitoring all the time. They hear everything you say, even if you don't have anybody on the line and you could talk about other stuff. People were scared to talk about it, except for those times in the coming or going. The shifts are all day long, they're 24 hours. They had start times every 30 minutes. So you didn't have a desk, so you never knew who you were going to be sitting next to. You came in and sat in whatever department you were in, whether it was domestic sales, international sales, around the world, whatever. You sat in your department, but you didn't sit at any particular place next to the same people every day. So the kind of the way that they had structured the workplace was very isolating and hard to talk to. So we had low support in all the res offices. We had such overwhelming support at the airports. We got over 50%, but didn't make it. At Eagle, they had either passenger service agents who did the ticketing and gate work, or people below the wing who did the baggage and the ramp work. And so we initially tried to file for just the above the wing work, because they have under the Railway Labor Act what they call a preponderance. If people are cross-utilized, they'll do these preponderance testing where they see where do you spend most of your time. It's a really ridiculous thing. Again, the units are so outdated under the Railway Labor Act, that it messed us up a couple of times with American Eagle. So we tried just doing the hubs, where people only did the above the wing work inside the airports, and the company made a big deal out of it and said this shows why you shouldn't vote for CWA, because their lack of experience under the Railway Labor Act. They don't understand that you can't file for an above the wing only unit. And this will only become important maybe later in the story if I can get through it. And then, so we refiled for everybody, including a fleet and passenger service group. Turnover was so high, again, because there was all this controversy about who was in the unit. It took a long time to get to the election, and turnover was so high at American Eagle. We couldn't maintain. We couldn't maintain. So we lost that election at American Eagle. We were regrouping at American, and there were rumors of American buying TWA, the airline. Some people will remember that. It was a really great airline. The passenger service agents there were union, They were in the machinist union. But we thought we had this 17,000 people unit at American, 4,000 at TWA. We started looking at it. There were 4,000 there with 21,000 people and the support of 4,000 more union people who had had a union. We could win, even if we couldn't, even if we maintained the support we had at the res offices. But we couldn't approach those workers during the time that the company was talking about merging because they were represented by another union. We did try to approach the other union, and without getting too negative about it, they were not interested in doing anything jointly with us. And when the final merger actually happened in September of 2001, they decided to give up representation rights and not join in. So when they gave up representation rights, we had the right to approach the TWA agents. The company had given all kinds of commitments to TWA employees and the unions that represented them about how they wanted to keep St. Louis as a hub. They would keep the reservation offices there. They weren't going to lay off anybody, all that kind of thing. So that was September 2001. And then there was 9/11. Or maybe it was August. Anyway, TWA had only just been purchased, and there was 9/11. And as the dust settled after 9/11, there was, the hatchet started happening. Airlines started closing every place. People were furloughed. Reservations offices were closed. The company did decide that TWA people were expendable first, and they got rid of TWA people. And then for the res agents who didn't have a union, they said that they would staple them to the bottom of the seniority list, which made the American agents very happy, because seniority is everything. And in airlines, it's do you get laid off? What shift can you bid on? What departments can you bid on? So they furloughed a lot of people were furloughed, and we recognize as that happened over the following year to year and a half after the 9/11, it was very clear we couldn't have another election because the majority of the unit was furloughed. So you really had no way of contacting them or talking to them or seeing them, and people were really demoralized. And if they weren't furloughed, they gave the state more stations over to American Eagle to lower the cost. They contracted out more stations to there became a whole industry of contractors who did station work both below the wing and above the wing. The people who went to work for another airline were going to be not eligible, but everybody else would still be eligible to vote. So in 2003, so we met. The leaders had conference calls about what to do next. They said, "We need you all now more than we've got to be a force now more than ever because of all, we got to have a voice in what's happening with all these closures." And so we formed what was called the Association of Passenger Service Agents, formed a local 6001. It was headquartered in Dallas, and we said they had worked with some of the Texas State Employees Union members and had been really interested in what they were doing of having a union with no hope of immediate collective bargaining and not even, signing cards and trying to get to an election. And they said, "But, what about something like this?" And the leadership decided that they thought that was a good idea. And we'd try it, and we'd form, these organizing committees, and would do same kind of activist work. We could work on, there has to be reauthorizations of the airline, what's it called? Anyway, airline reauthorizations every so often that Congress has to do. We could try to get some things in that. There were the flight attendants had gotten some language on unruly customers and what to do with unruly customers that are, in the on all of the terrorism things. And so we got passenger service agents included in that language so that you could call in instead of having to leave it to the whim of the station manager about whether or not a passenger was unruly enough to tell them you can't get on the plane and you have to leave. It was up to the, it was a federal mandate.
Sandy, this is fascinating. I'm just looking at time because we have a lot to do in terms of the airlines. So let's try and not have every detail, even though it's fascinating. Okay, so we've now got this passenger service
So we had the Passenger
organization.
Service Association, and we worked with that for a number of years. Again, people had 10-year recall rights. We were kind of waiting for the 10-year period when people wouldn't have recall rights. And what happened was there were a lot of rumors that American was going to go bankrupt. All the other major legacy carriers had declared bankruptcy and had gotten rid of a lot of their debt. And American was trying not to, but in the end, in 2011, they declared bankruptcy. Passenger service agents said, "We have to have a voice in this process. We can't, please let us try to get to an election again." Because we know this is going to be terrible. So we did. We put out cards again, filed for an election quickly. We filed with, so the bankruptcy was like November of 2011. We filed very quickly and with just over 35% that you can do, you could do in the industry so that we could try to get some claim to this. Did a bunch of stuff to get a voice in bankruptcy court, which I won't go into because it's a detail we don't need to know. The American and other airlines, so in 2010 was when they changed the rule about the 50% plus one having to vote, and if you were a no, if you didn't vote, you were a no vote. So it was 50% plus one of eligible voters had to vote yes. If you didn't vote, you were a no vote. In 2010, that changed with Obama's appointment of Linda Pachalla
And that
and
had
the
been a
other.
big focus of CWA to get that change.
We worked heavily on that, and that's one of the things that the Association of Passenger Service Agents worked on. And then Congress was upset about that rule change. And changed the law that you had to have in like February, I guess, of 2012. You had to have a 50% showing of interest, not a 35% showing of interest.
But the vote still was, the base was still of those who voted, not.
Of those who voted, yes. So the company held up that election for years, several years. By first taking us to court, and then we finally won at the appellate level, and then they said we had to meet the standard, the new standard of a 50% showing. Well, we knew with what we had filed a year before, we weren't going to meet the standard because you can't add cards as you go along. Like you give the cards in, the company's supposed to submit a list. They never submitted a list. So they held it up again, saying we had to meet the 50% showing. It was ruled in court that they can't retroactively apply that to a filing that we made before the law was changed. And then the company, so the NMB, we scheduled this election, I think, four times, and they kept getting injunctions and that sort of thing. And then finally they said, you have to turn over the list to us. The company refused to turn over the eligibility list. So finally, we said, we'll bring you one. And the board was going to take our list if the company wouldn't turn over the list. And so the company reluctantly turned over the list to try to again pad the list. And during that whole time, they were in bankruptcy, and it said, and they gave them another reason to start shutting down more airports. They knew our strength was in the airports. They told people that you had to, you're never going to get a job back, even though technically those people should have been eligible to vote under recall. They said, we won't reopen this location ever. So by the time we got to the election, we had lost, I think we'd filed with what we thought was about 10,000 people, and there were 7,700 in the unit because they got rid of that many people off the eligibility list. And we lost by 150 votes in that election. So
Oh
that would
my
have been
goodness.
this 2013. And within a month, there were rumors that they were trying to merge with US Airways, where we represented the agents. What I didn't mention is that in those years, US Airways had bought America West, another airline. America West passenger service agents had been represented by the Teamsters. We had decided rather than to fight in an election with the Teamsters over who would represent the agents, that we would do joint representation. The Teamsters got everything west of the Mississippi, and we got everything east of the Mississippi. It was tough because we both had to give up agents that had been in our union for a while and really fought to be in it. But we decided that that was, the agents decided that was the best thing. So we were doing joint bargaining and joint representation with the Teamsters. The merger was discussed. It was at first turned down. Ultimately, the Justice Department did decide, again, without going into minute detail, it was decided that they could merge. They
And
merged.
do I recall that the CWA supported the merger?
We did support the merger. We thought it would be the best thing for the US Airways was having a hard time being a fourth legacy carrier. Southwest wasn't considered a legacy carrier, so you had Delta, United, and American, and US Airways was considerably smaller and more concentrated in certain areas. We decided, so we had to have another election. This time, the union group, US Airways, was smaller than the non-union group, American, but they'd been working together for a long time. We'd had the US Airways agents involved in the American campaign for a very long time. And so it wasn't seen as antagonistic. They were excited to be merging. They knew each other. With great difficulty, we agreed to do a joint representation with the Teamsters. And I won't go into that messy stuff, but
Why not?
it. Well, did you want me? I thought you didn't want me to go into too much detail.
Well, I think that that's it summarize the messy stuff of negotiating with the Teamsters over joint
Well, we
representation.
they had, I think they represented, I'm trying to remember what the size of the unit would have been. At US Airways, they probably had 1,200 people and we had 5,000 or something like that. So we represented the majority of the US Airway group, even though that they we there was evenness on the bargaining committee. We had the same number of people on the bargaining committee and that kind of thing. And then we had had this campaign with Americans since, 1996, and had just barely lost an election. And so an American was the bigger group, the almost eight over eight about 8,000 people. And so we just thought that that wasn't right. And we had really strong activists who had been with us the whole time that were on the West Coast. And but all the way up to make the decision that if we won the election, they were going to be part of the Teamsters. was very hard. We had, some gut-wrenching conversations, and people decided the important thing was that everybody had a union. U.S. Airways keep their union, and American get one finally, whoever represented them. So we decided to do it, but that we would run, that CWA would run the campaign. CWA would do what we'd been doing. The Teamsters would be the organizers in the airports and reservation offices that were west of the Mississippi. We had a tough transition of our committees over to that, but anyway, that's what we did. We had that election in 2014, and we won overwhelmingly. I think it was 86%. There were about 15,000 people, around 15,000 people in the unit. And we won. We had won at Piedmont several years before that. And then about a year after that, we ended up winning at American Eagle, which was called Envoy by that time. We finally won representation with those units. So in terms of our passenger service units, we now have American, Piedmont, and Envoy.
Sandy, this is an amazing story. Just to clarify then, after winning the merged American US Airways, west of the Mississippi is represented by Teamsters.
It is. And
Okay.
east of the Mississippi is represented by us. We do have some of the things we got in the agreement. We did redo the representation and negotiation agreement with the Teamsters because our group on east of the Mississippi was going to be so much larger that we have proportional representation now. So how many people you elect on the bargaining committee is proportionate to how many each union has. And then we decided on our part that it would be reservations and airports would be guaranteed seats on the bargaining committee. So you had represent because the issues are very, very different. And I didn't say, I think probably one of the key things to say during that time is in terms of organizing and thinking about call center workers particularly. And we had been bargaining in other industries. Companies had come and talked about doing home-based customer service work, and we had been reluctant to enter into that. I think probably after it was probably after about 2004, after 2001, when the companies started cutting and closing reservations offices, they still needed reservation agents when the industry started coming back. So they started putting all new hires were home-based. Initially, you had to be within a 15-mile vicinity of a reservation of a brick and mortar. And pretty soon that expanded to like 75 miles. And pretty soon they could do it. They could have done it anywhere if they'd wanted to. They still wanted people to be able to come in and do trainings and that sort of thing occasionally. So the home-based program, much lower pay, different benefits, different sick and vacation benefits. You had to pay for your own equipment. You had to have a designated area in your house, which they'd come and look at. It was not the job that had been at the centers. So all the hiring had been done home-based after 2004 in the American locations. The US Airways agents saw what was happening and they preemptively bargained for home-based work. US Airways never set up home-based work, but we had very good contract language about what would happen in terms of same pay, same benefits, how it would decide who went home. the American agents were really interested in that. Even reservations agents, perked up their ears. And if we could contact them, the more home-based agents there were, they knew they were getting the shaft in terms of how they were being treated. And when we were able to contact them, which was very hard to do, we started doing much more home visiting than we had done in the past. We started doing little coffees and that kind of stuff at people's houses because they oftentimes knew the other people that worked around them. To get off the job, people had to swap with each other. You could say, "Debbie, will you take my morning shift if I take your evening shift?" And so there were a whole list of people that other people knew because they were swapping buddies. So we worked through those kind of lists. But it was very hard to know even, what the size of the group was. So we did that last the last two organizing campaigns, we did really trying to figure out how to organize and keep solidarity and a sense of community among people who are working from their homes and hardly ever came into a reservation office except for to do training.
This
And
is now very important today. So, what did you learn? What would you share with people today who have units that work at home, not just in airlines, but in other sectors like telecom now?
I think that you just have to like think of all the ways that they're already connected with each other. I mean, it's something that you learn as a fundamental of organizing. You can't go into a workplace and know the different ways people are separated or connected with each other. What the informal and formal kind of social networks are, what and why do people talk to each other? Like for flight attendants, it's definitely swapping. Dropping and swapping flights is a major way people connect with each other. And so that was true for home-based agents. And to do mobilization kind of things, we did on Facebook, we'd do pick badges. So they could wear, because we'd have wear your button today, wear your pin. When we were voting, we had one color of pin if they hadn't voted yet, and then they'd swap it out to show that they had voted a red pin or a green pin. And so they would do that on on the pick badge, Facebook groups, again, swap groups and people who lived in the same communities. And they loved, we were a vehicle to bring people together. We'd be like, "Did you know that there was another res agent that lives just like down the block from you?" And so it was really a way once we could finally get some phone numbers and some addresses and actually connect people, it was a way that people could see each other and know each other, which was an advantage to them. Because you're more likely to swap if Debbie calls and says, "My daughter's sick today and I really can't, I have to take her to the doctor." You're more likely to swap if you know her and you're kind of friendly with her than if she contacts you out of the blue. So I think really digging deep in understanding what those networks were what was important. People who had worked at the reservations office and had gone home base, or if their whole department had been made to go home base and they either had the option of staying in that department or moving to a different kind of reservations. All of those were ways that people could were connected with each other that we had to dig into.
Okay, so now we're at about, thanks.
Okay.
Now we're at 2014, and we now have one represent. We, CWA, has one representation. Before we get into the bargaining, which I want you to talk about, particularly in terms of the home based, I want to ask a couple questions about organizing. First of all, you as an organizer, Sandy, who coordinated this more than 10-year campaign to represent these folks who lost, you said in the beginning, multiple elections. How does it feel and how do you keep going personally?
To have lost the elections, Should you want me to
You
start with
lose,
that?
you work really hard, you lose an election, right? How's it feel? How do you pick yourself up? How do you help other people pick themselves up?
I remember the day that we got the decision from the NMB that they wouldn't rerun the election in 98. Because by that time we'd figure out some of the stuff that we'd done wrong. I was pretty sure we could win that election. And then we weren't going to get it. And I was literally coming home. We'd had a strategy meeting in Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina, and I was getting on the plane to fly home, where we were like, okay, the second election, this redo election, here's the strategy. And I had to fly into DFW Airport and see all these people who over the years have become very good friends with, but that even 3 years with them, and tell them we weren't going to get another election. It was really heartbreaking. We had really worked to build ourselves up to the second election and do what they did at US Airways. So it was, the thing is, I had to keep saying, but we'll keep at it. And so on, whether it was conference calls or whatever, I had to be very upbeat and positive, and make myself believe that we'd have another shot at it, and we kind of figured out what the problem was. But by the time we had the last election, the American agents had gone through so much and had been with us for so long, and had, I mean, no one had thought of, like, you're going to pay dues to an organization that doesn't have collective bargaining, particularly in an industry where there was so much collective bargaining all around you. It seemed like a really crazy, kooky idea. But people were trained in using the in-house grievance procedure really well. We were running 90% of our grievances. People were actually very excited about what they were doing on the job, but they definitely knew it was not collective bargaining. So that we had so many joyous occasions and celebrated the work that we were doing. But I had probably monthly conference calls. Out of those years, probably there was only a couple of years where I didn't have monthly conference calls with people. And even during those years where it was a little bit slower, it was probably every 2 months. So we never stopped doing stuff. And I don't do anything that I don't think there's some hope of that the workers will prevail, or that what we're doing just by organizing is holding at bay, whether it was through bankruptcy or after 9/11, or all of those times where it could have been a total bloodbath. I think our organizing really kept the company more in line than they would have been. And I will say, besides the merger, the last thing, besides the merger, and having the US Airways agents, included in the numbers and involved in the organizing, the management that took over the new American was the old US Airway management, who had come from the old America West. It was like the little fish eating the big fish. And they had a different attitude about, I mean, American, even though all their other union groups were organized, they acted like it would be the death of them if the passenger service agents were in the union. And that was not the mentality of the new American leadership that came over from US Airways. The labor relations had been dealing with us, and they'd been dealing with us at the bargaining table. The managers over flight services. So we had a different, there was a totally different feeling at the airline after the US Airway management took over the management of American Airlines.
Did any of that have to do with the fact that CWA had actively used its political leverage to support the merger?
I believe so. I mean, none of that is ever said. And it's our support for it certainly wasn't contingent on anything except that we thought it would be the best thing for the people that we represented at US Airways so that it didn't go into another bankruptcy. We had been through a bankruptcy with them and actually worked under a bankruptcy contract for too many years. The other difference under the Railway Labor Act is contracts never expire. They just become amendable. So you can work under the same contract for many, many years. And the ability to strike is almost non-existent. I think that it did, but or it's just they dealt with unions and they dealt with us and they weren't it wasn't as big of a deal to them.
Back to how you keep going in a campaign that is national 10 years. Who did you turn to for support?
Well, the other person that helped lead American and then American Eagle and Envoy was Susan Baxter Fleming. She was the district organizing coordinator in District 4, which is kind of the Midwest area of CWA, and I had her and Mike Lavolo, who's now a CWA staff rep, he stuck with that campaign the whole time. Other people worked on and off on it. Larry Cohen, the organizing director, and then later the EVP of executive vice president, and then later the president of CWA, who's in all those positions while we were doing these campaigns, was relentlessly supportive and a cheerleader for the campaign. And we had times when it was a when we were doing the Association of Passenger Service Agents, I was probably the only district organizing coordinator spending time on it. I'd go to other districts and we'd go to especially the hubs where the association was the largest. We did grievance trainings and that kind of stuff. So it wasn't like there was a ton of CWA time and money spent on it, but there was always resources. That whole time, there were resources going into it.
Sandy, we've got 45 minutes. I want to do a hard stop at 2. There's a lot to cover, so I'm going to try and move us through quickly. Your stories and the level of detail in your memory is unbelievable. I know there were some major gains in the, it was a long time to get a contract at American. When you finally did, there were some major gains. Do you want to just summarize what some of those were?
Oh God, I'd have to really go back. So I wasn't, I continued to work with the unit in terms of signing them up as members. You're required to be a member under the Railway Labor Act. It's not a state by state decision on there are right to work doesn't make any difference. So everybody has to be a member, but you want people to be a member and be able to vote on the contract and vote on their bargaining team and that kind of stuff. And so we turned our organizing group into signing people up, and that was really my focus, and helping with mobilization in the field. Marge Krueger, who had been a district organizing coordinator and is and then became the sort of chair of the airline sector, passenger service sector of the airlines in CWA. She did the bargaining for that unit, and we really were trying to, and we wanted to make improvements for US Airways too. Again, they had been working under a bankruptcy contract for a lot of years. So pay was a huge change. Some things for American were bringing them up to the standards of US Airways. Some things they wanted something a little bit different than what was in the US Airway contract, but just who could be held over at the airports, being held over and working double shifts over and over again and not knowing if you'd be able to get off and pick your kid up or if you'd need daycare or if whatever was a huge thing. And so the requirement for how much notice they have to give, who gets the assignment, is it based on seniority or just because you're unlucky enough to be working at that gate on that terminal? If you get double pay, if they, how much pay you get if they can't give you the kind of notice that they get. So all of those things, these are, very, very detailed things, but made people's lives more manageable in addition to raising their salary for
And my memory is you achieved parity for the at home.
yes,
And that was a huge, huge pay increase for them. Okay.
Yes, it was a very big thing. And then how you become home base, how you get to go back to the office. I mean, strangely enough, the company, and maybe it's because the leadership there is now US Airways, and they never implemented, even though we bargained it, a home base program. There's less and less focus on that now, and people are going back into the offices.
When you say now, do you mean now or do you mean when
Now.
you retired?
When I retired, and I'm not absolutely sure what's going on now.
Yeah, I wanted to check on that because I think COVID had implications for
Yeah,
call
yes, it
centers.
did. That's true. And we did just bargain a new contract. I don't think it's been ratified yet at American.
Let's talk a little bit about cable organizing.
In addition to seeing jobs go to wireless at the phone company, what we could also see is that the internet and broadband work was also moving to cable companies, and that all of us had cable organizing when way back in the 80s and 90s. Probably, I'm sure people did before that, but I didn't become an national organizing staff until 91. But it was a lot of mom and pop cable companies. So you had the XYZ cable company in, Springfield, Missouri, and a group of 30 people called you and wanted to have a union. We could win those elections. It was really terrible working conditions. They were all pretty tight-knit groups of people. You could win an election and then you could never get a contract, was our experience in bargaining. And then, as much as a local might really work to hold on to the group and keep them involved, you'd go through decert after decertification after decertification effort, and then slowly people would lose interest, and the unit would turn over, and you'd finally lose a decertification. So we had some small pockets of internet broadband. Cable, what were called cable companies, but were doing their line was carrying much more than that, and that we'd maintain, but not very much. All of us had pretty
Okay,
much had the
let's
same
jump
scripts.
ahead.
So we,
AT&T buys TCI Cable. I believe it's in 1998. And so now AT&T is a big cable company. And
and
CWA, as I recall, negotiated certain kind of language and decides to launch a more concerted effort to organize those units. So let's talk
So
about that.
this was before Southwestern Bell bought AT&T,
Correct.
and AT&T is still long distance, but has tried to venture into other areas. So with the deal, we supported the deal for them to buy TCI. We'd all had a bunch of campaigns with TCI and had been horrible, with John Malone as the head.
Viciously anti-union.
Viciously anti-union. We'd never gotten a contract with, for example, the 401k, and even if we'd get a contract, they made sure we didn't have certain things. So We were supportive. They agreed to a neutrality language, that they would be neutral in elections, but we would have to have elections. We would not have card check elections, but there would be neutral third party that would be assigned to it, that there would be several arbitrators that we could arbitrate any issue around the election process or the campaigning during the election process. And the ultimate thing was within, I think it was 2 years after the signing of that, that if we had shown that they had systematically violated the neutrality agreement, that we would get card check. So we all were supposed to start all across the country, if we had these units, start organizing campaigns and move forward to elections because we wanted to use the whole process and see how it worked in terms of the unit and the type of, anyway, all those nitty-gritty things about the election and the campaigning, and that we would document. It was really important to document every single part of them violating the neutrality agreement, things we might have taken for granted that you can run under the National Labor Relations Act that are fine, that companies can get away with. We're not okay under neutrality, and we would document. So we all went out and had we did training for locals all around the country. A lot of AT&T, core AT&T, or the Southwestern Bell unit that was, or the RBOC, whatever telco local we had in the area where there was a TCI unit, would be trained, and people would go back and start getting contacts and would try to start campaigns. And even if they weren't perfect campaigns, or even if we didn't, it was it, we hearkened back to Danny Fatani's lose to win. Even if you lost, if you could document the campaign so that we got the documentation that we needed to bring this to a arbitrator if we had to get a card check. And we all did that. I don't know. I was still in District 6. We probably ran 10 different elections. We won about half of them, lost the other ones, but got great documentation in all of them. We started doing bargaining on the ones that we won. We started doing the at least coordinated bargaining. So there would be a person assigned in every district that would try to bargain that AT&T broadband contract, and that we got similar things so that they didn't whipsaw us like TCI had. And I'm not sure what happened. We got to the point where we had great documentation. We wanted to take it to arbitration, and for some reason there was a decision that you'll probably have to go back and interview George Cole about to understand why, but we didn't go forward with the we didn't go forward with that to get card check, and they ultimately decided they didn't want to be in that business, and got rid of that subsidiary. So it was a failed one of our failed efforts after we'd gotten organizing rights that we didn't organize. We may have a small number of units. I know we lost all the ones that we had in District 6. After that, after they
Do
were
you
sold
remember
off.
who bought AT&T broadband? I'll answer
Who?
my own question.
Okay.
Comcast.
Oh, that's right.
Comcast.
That's right.
And
And so,
my.
oh, that's right. We kept them for a while. We kept the units that we had. We didn't get the organizing rights agreement, kept the units that we had under Comcast. They said, they gave some promises, but it was bullshit. To be frank, without going into detail, and we systematically lost. I had several more elections with Comcast that were horrible. We won one, I think, and lost one. I think we never got to a contract on the one we lost. We won after it was Comcast, but we ended up losing all of them.
Yeah.
I don't know if we have anything. I think Marge Krueger kept bargaining the contracts in District 213. and really held those units together in a great way. And we may still have something there.
Pittsburgh. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Now we're going to come up to when did you become national co organizing coordinator?
In 2012, I became national organizing coordinator.
And when did you retire?
In 2019.
Okay. So first, without detail, list some of the major campaigns of that period, and then I'll let you pick which ones to talk about in more detail.
We had I mean, one of the major things is we knew with it was now called AT&T Wireless, the old Southwestern Bell Wireless, and then called Singular, and then called AT&T Wireless after they bought AT&T, that they were competing against the non-union Verizon Wireless and T-Mobile Wireless, and that the standards were very different in those companies, and that if we allowed that to happen without serious organizing campaigns in both, to raise the standards either through our organizing or winning in those places, that it would be very difficult. T-Mobile had been a company that was, what was the name before Deutsche
Georgia,
Telekom bought them?
I don't remember. VoiceStream?
Anyway,
VoiceStream or
maybe
something?
VoiceStream, but when they were purchased by a German company called that was unionized, Deutsche Telekom was purchased it. We met with the German union ver.di that represented the Deutsche Telekom wireless workers and landline workers, and they said, our company, we think this would be good for both of us. Our company will not do this. They won't react like this. They're used to working with the union. It would be much better. We had all had came I had had several campaigns with VoiceStream. It was pretty awful. And so we were very much looking forward to a German company that had a good union track record, and working with ver.di, the union there, to look at trying to organize T-Mobile. And so I think that happened in 2007 or 8. Do you remember?
I'll look it
Anyway,
up. Yeah.
I don't remember those dates like I remember the American ones. But so we started a campaign in T-Mobile that continued during the time I was the organizing director. And then Verizon, we had
Wait,
gotten.
I don't want you to jump up. I want you to
Okay.
stick with T-Mobile because I think it was
Okay.
very unique, the globe international partnership with their D. And how that was developed, how it was sustained.
So once we started organizing at T-Mobile, they did the predictable. The company in the United States basically told the Germans that they needed to take a hands-off approach, that we had different standards and policies and laws in the United States, that they would abide by the law, but the law gave them, leeway to do things, and that they would run things like they run things in the United States. So there started to be an anti-union campaign. The company, ver.di, would go to their parent company and say, this isn't right what you're doing. This is really awful. The company would be saying they're not running an anti-union campaign. And so very early on, we started having the Germans, top levels of the German union ver.di, come to the United States and go with us to meet with workers and hand bill in front of locations. And mostly we started with the call centers. They had call centers, retail workers, and a small amount of technicians, outside technicians who worked the towers and that sort of thing. And so ver.di leadership would come over and see the terror in people's eyes. They're not being willing to take a flyer. Management coming out and taking pictures of us, doing surveillance, telling us we didn't have the right to be there, telling workers would come out and say, you know why all the shades are drawn? The company told us that we had to all shut our shades and no one look out at those sorts of things. Things that most people would find regular and minor in the United States, the German union leadership was horrified at. They even said they have in Germany a seat on what's called the Board of Supervisors, which is like our board of directors here. The union has seats on the board of directors. So they tried one at several different places to go and say, I'm actually on the board of supervisors of this company. I'd like to come in to the call center. Well, they said, you're trespassing. It's illegal for you to be here. Security escorted them off after numerous phone calls and that sort of thing, where they were clearly calling the upper level people. So they were, it this wasn't some isolated security guard who didn't know what they were doing. They were calling labor relations. Sometimes the local call center labor relations would come out and say the same thing. So we became closer and closer to Verdi in our anger against the company and Deutsche Telekom, who had made agreement, had actually met with the president of our union to say that they wouldn't run an anti-union campaign if they took over VoiceStream in the United States. So there became a closer and closer relationship, and which really developed over time. When I left in 2019, we were still working on T-Mobile and developing that relationship. And over time, it deepened in a way that, like, we'd have a call center in one part of Germany, a Deutsche Telekom call center, who would basically adopt and agree to support a call center in the United States. And the workers at each place, would have regular conference calls with each other. We'd send delegations to go to each other's call center. So we'd have a delegation from Wichita, Kansas, go to, a location in Germany. I want to say Dusseldorf. I can't remember which one they were paired with, but and see what the difference of was in terms of monitoring and speed up and, all those things that they were upset at in the United States. See how it was dealt with through the councils, the work councils that were run by the union in Deutsche Telekom. And then they would come to the United States, to Wichita, Kansas, and spend a week there and talk to workers, tell them what it was like to have a union with this company. So the in many ways, the relationship really got deeper in both unions. There became more and more support in the German union as people felt stronger that they could have it, that they should be able to have a union here in the United States. And that sort of relationship developed to where we formed again a membership organization that was not moving immediately towards collective bargaining in these big call centers, but a membership organization that people could join that was called TU, that was a union that they were, when they joined and they paid dues, they were part of both CWA and Verdi. And so it was that sort of that kind of relationship we had. And then in the union level, CWA organizing staff and leaders from the president of our union with other people, with the head of the research department and the legislative staff would meet with the heads of the telecom part of Verdi to strategize and plan and talk about how they both use their positions as and they were reluctant initially to bring it up as supervisor the board of supervisors. And as the company's behavior got worse and worse, that changed. We did organize a few small units of T-Mobile, a Metro PCS unit, a group of cable a group of technicians, outside technicians, that we represented and had collective bargaining agreements with. But we were never able to build it to a mass level. We did get to the point of talking some about having some language of respect, and it wasn't, I wouldn't call it a neutrality agreement, but it was, some people called it neutrality light, but some form of peace. We had so many different NLRB violations against them. We got people their jobs back. We got money back. Well, actually, they never hired people because ultimately
Sandy,
people.
I was going to ask a general question, but I think a specific will help answer this as to why ultimately the campaign did not succeed in organizing. Except, can you tell the story of what happened when that little store of Metro PCS, which was a subsidiary of T-Mobile, looked like they were going to vote for the union? What did T-Mobile do?
They brought in everybody
So
from
tell
the
that
top.
detail. I think that explains what workers face when their
Yeah,
company
this was
really
a,
is opposed to it.
those were the Metro PCS stores were even smaller than the T-Mobile retail stores. So I think there were 10 people there
This is
at
in
that
New York
store
City, correct?
in New York City. Yes. And first they brought in, the area manager, and then the regional manager, and ultimately, the CEO of T-Mobile was this high profile, thought he was a rock star, treated himself like a rock star, and made everybody do big things when he came to visit John Ledger. He shows up at the store, says it was just he was in New York and needed to do something with his phone. Everybody showed up, but they had several people. These were more the HR kind of people that would, they had a basement in the retail store. One of the things they did was individually take people into the basement and grill them about their support for CWA, support for the union, how are they going to vote, who else was going to vote, that sort of thing. And it was really, even for the what we had was very strong leadership there. It was really scary and really intimidating. And the District One organizers really pulled out the works. They had, I think it was, now that I'm saying this, was it Hakeem Jeffries? He wasn't the speaker of that. He wasn't the minority leader at the time. But the local legislative people come by and give them, we're for you. All the strong union people in the New York area that you can think of came by and gave them we're supporting you. And we actually ended up, in spite of the atrocious campaign there, we won that. A real tribute to the inside leadership and the way that they felt supported in that area by the local and by the local politicians.
You were going to
And we ultimately, there were several conversations during the time that we were organizing that maybe AT&T would be able to buy T-Mobile, and they never got through the regulatory process of being able to do that. We had two hopeful times with that, and we very much supported that. It would have made the world of difference to the T-Mobile workers and to our AT&T mobility workers, but that never happened. And ultimately, they let Sprint, which was the other really anti-union wireless company, they allowed Sprint to buy T-Mobile.
the
That's the
Democratic DOJ turned down AT&T T-Mobile, and the Trump Republican DOJ allowed the T-Mobile Sprint merger to go through.
correct.
Let's limit the last conversation, you were going to talk about, say something about Verizon Wireless.
Yeah, just Verizon Wireless. District One had gotten a Verizon agreement on neutrality with Verizon Wireless, and just I wasn't directly involved, so I shouldn't speak for it. But I will say they never lived up to it. They never lived up to that agreement, and so we had to think about organizing Verizon in a different way. We had a campaign and have an ongoing campaign in wireless, but really have not been able to break through. It shows the importance of between big and these big and little units. You just have to have some kind of organizing rights agreement to really be able to make the kind of dent. We could organize small groups. We did organize a, Verizon Wireless retail, and you can get small groups, but maintaining those and getting a contract without having the company say we're going to accept that we're going to be in partnership with you in some way. I think the neutrality isn't just the right to organize. It's really the company at some point saying we're gonna work with you. And so whether it's on organizing or bargaining or other things, it is worth trying to get to that point, because it's not just organizing. It's whether or not you can have that group be a viable entity for the long run, I think.
I think you've opened up where I wanted to spend the last few minutes of this fabulous conversation. And that is, what would you say you've learned over this 40-year career about what it takes to successfully have workers win their collective rights for a union and negotiate a contract?
Well, I'm going to start before and negotiate a contract. I'd say, one of the things that I think we learn and then we relearn is that almost anywhere you can find some workers who will take risks. And we're certainly finding, right now, more workers that are supportive of unions, that understand what unions have done, that are willing to take risks. The way the laws are set up, which is on a particular day, if you have to go through those rules, which is on a particular day at a particular time, can workers withstand the lengthy period of time it takes to get to an election and win an election under these rules? It's very hard, and so we have to find other ways to do it or other ways to support people and use the laws that we have. I mean, we're not forgetting those, and there are some places that it can work, in places that are more heavily union, that have other unions around. In my district or the state that I live in now, which is the least unionized state in the country, it's not that you couldn't do that. It's that all the forces are against you, not just if the company decides to take a different stance, but the political forces are against you doing it. And we've seen it with the United Auto Workers Union, with Volkswagen, it's very hard for workers if their neighbors are against them organizing, and the company is against them organizing to hold up under that. But people do, people will, and people do, and we should support them when we can. The more locals we have organizing, and the more people we have in communities that are skilled at organizing, the more we can do. And so I think in terms of our organizing program, continuing to balance having people, we've through a lot of ways that we're using our resources differently, we've been able to increase the number of kind of full-time people that are doing organizing that I never would have dreamed of when I came on the staff. So we have a large number of people doing that. But some of these things, you got to have people in big and small communities. We have CWA has a unique ability because we represent the telephone company to be in all across the country. We don't, in most places, we don't just have one big factory in one place that if it's not there, we can't support the other things. So we have a lot more we can do in developing our own capacity, and we continue to try to do it, but you're often pulled into the campaign that you're working on and able to build the capacity. It's always a struggle between those two things. And I think one of the things I want, you have to pay attention. You have to pay attention to both of those, capacity building and campaigns and where the, you know, the iron is hot now. And we, even with our increased capacity, don't have enough people to take it, to help support the organizing of all the people that are coming to us saying they want to have a union, much less our strategic campaigns. I think the other thing we
Hannah,
learned.
oh, Hannah, I
Okay.
want to give you an opportunity. So think about a question you might have. But Sandy, I interrupted you.
And then strategic campaigns and the things that come to us. And so we have to continue to represent our core work. And that core work is, you know, from newspapers to passenger service agents to telecommunications to manufacturing. I mean, we have a lot of different pieces of public sector. The core work is very broad in CWA now, and we have to be strategic about representing our core work while also looking, I mean, since I've left, Tom Smith, who's the new organizing director, and his assistant, Tim, have really done a great job in the you know, the new technology, the gaming industry, Microsoft, some of the new, some of that high techie work that we've done, we poked around at for a lot of years from starting with IBM forward, and I won't go into all those, but we're really like digging into it now in a different way. That's very exciting. And again, we talked about earlier, we said we were the Union for the Information Age many, many years ago. And I think the information age is so, it's almost everything now. But breaking into that industry, I think it is important. And we could be doing so much more if we had more capacity. And again, Tom and Tim have to figure out a way to balance the, you know, working on the capacity and working on these campaigns that are ripe and hot.
Right.
And
Hannah,
you have to do both of those things, I think. Yeah.
do you want to ask any questions? And you're on mute if you do.
Is there a story of a time where someone or something really surprised you? And if that's too general, then I can think of a different
Yeah,
question.
probably. I mean, I'm sure there are. I don't know that I could pull out one. I'm constantly amazed at the internal leaders we find who are willing to go through the hell they had to go through to get a union. I mean, we have a unit in, and these aren't particularly good stories, but I'm going to tell them because we have a unit of Dish Network, a satellite cable company that we organized. I don't know. I organized them in maybe 2008 or 9. We still have them, and they faced against deserts and, you know, one thing after another. They've continued to stick with the union. Different leadership. They fired the whole top level of our leadership, and they're still there. And the other thing is, I remember one woman that was involved. It was a publishing company, Knowles Publishing, and it was a horrible campaign. And the guy, it was independently owned by this Robert Knowles, and he had again fired our top level of leadership, fired our second level of leadership. Leaders kept coming forward. They sold books, law books, and other books online, and did customer service. And he had big signs the day of the election who do you trust, the union or Bob Knowles? And his daughter was the labor relations person. And the right after they voted no, barely voted no, he closed him down. Said he'd rather, because he thought there were pieces of union support, because we came close, still there, and he'd rather not have a company than have a union company. He was good to his word. He said he'd close them if they won, and instead he closed them when they lost. And one of the women, and not originally in the top tier, came up to me and said, "I am so proud of what we've done here. Everyone's going to know now. Those signs that said, 'Who do you trust, the union or Bob Knowles?' Well, they'll have a different opinion when they go to their next workplace." And was like thrilled that we'd stuck with it and stayed with it, and that we'd had an election, and that sort of attitude. And it did happen. I had a bunch of campaigns that we lost, and people went on to the next thing, and we won the next. They were in these other like cable units, and we won later, and they did finally get a union. And that people are so determined and not discouraged and hopeful enough to start another campaign, to be the one that called and said, "Hey, I'm now over at Salmon's Cable, and it's even worse over here than it was at TCI." So yeah, I think time after time, and then our own organizing staff, it is amazing how many times I had to say, "We're going to work through Thanksgiving, and we're going to work through Christmas, and we're going to work, we have to, because ballots are out and we have an election." And you don't even have to say it. I mean, no one would think of, I have to think about my own personal time during that time when it's critical. So I think I've, working with such a great group of people all along through my career, the organizing staff and a lot of the other staff that supported it. I don't want to diminish that. It's been, I talked about at the start, not being wanting not wanting to be an organizer, and sort of moved into it by a really great organizer, Danny. And then I never questioned that decision.
Hannah, any other? Because that was a great question.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, but is there any one person on the organizing staff, or people in union members that you worked with who you just want to like give a shout out and say like something they did that inspired you?
I hope I've given enough names. I mean, I think we're kind of under the you don't do anything by yourself. It's the numerous people that I haven't said their names, like literally thousands of people that I haven't said their names, and some of the people that I did mention, but you can't give enough credit for what we've done to the number of people that have touched all the campaigns. And I do feel like during the time I was the organizing director, I kept saying, "Why would I have to move to Washington, D.C. to be the organizing director?" Well, I understood once I got there, because the different departments really clicking and working together to move our organizing campaigns forward, from research to politics to legislative to, the chief of staff to, the legal department. In addition to the
Communications.
communications, yeah, I'm leaving. I know. I knew I was leaving something out. To this really, the IT people. I think it was humming together for the most part. We started having, I think, more meetings together on some of the campaigns, figuring out the ways the different departments could really support organizing, and they did. And then organizing, supporting internal organizing as well. So I'm leaving out a bunch of names, and I'm sorry for all those people that I've left out.
You
But
can.
no, I wouldn't name I wouldn't name one person, except for I think I've talked about a lot of people who influenced me.
You have. I have two last questions. I
Okay.
think the next generation is going to be listening to this. And what would you say to them?
I'd say keep trying and keep hoping. We just can never give up. And on the macro level, it's discouraging that the labor movement's at the lowest point in terms of the percentage organized than when I graduated from high school. But think what it would have been if there hadn't been people on the ground fighting for the rights that a lot of us take for granted, and are slowly seeing being deteriorated. I think it's a hopeful time, and we should keep moving forward, but come up with other new creative things. A lot of people thought we were very kooky in TSEU of what we were doing, but if you read history, it's not. And our first president of CWA, Joe Byrne, he was our first president, right,
Yes,
Debbie?
yes.
So there were stories about him. It's why I'm willing to talk about this, and why I do have hope. But we didn't even have an organizing department really then. And he and the other people, he actually directly did organizing, and that's been true of several of our presidents of CWA that did direct organizing. And he would he wore a big hat, and he would go to a place where they were organizing. This is the story, and I believe it. And pass around the hat, and people would put in money, and that would determine sort of where they got to in their next. In their next place they went. And so as much as we can say, oh, we don't have the resources, and we don't have the people, and the laws are terrible, and how can we organize in this? They did, and they figured out a way to do it on much fewer resources, and which with much less organizing capacity than we have. Don't it's important we keep trying.
Sandy, this was fabulous.